We hope you enjoy your stay. It's good to have you with us, even if it's just for the day. We hope you enjoy your stay. Outside the sun is shining, it seems like heaven ain't far away. It's good to have you with us, even if it's just for the day.
Hey yo, and here we go. It is the 2014 Calgary Comic Creators Summit. And I think we've doubled our...
The last one we did in 2014, January, I'm just saying.
We do it in January.
No, we did.
This podcast is already so over time.
I'm just saying. Why don't you say the third annual? Why don't you say the third annual?
Hey,
why don't
I? Oh boy!
welcome to the third annual.
We can just leave.
Though it's not quite annual if we did it 11 and a half months ago. The third annual Calgary Comic Creators Summit, and I think we've doubled our headcount over last year, which was doubled over the year before. So at this rate, in 5 years, the entire city will be turning up.
We'll leave it on.
Creators Summit.
We're going to need a bigger boat.
We'll be doing the Saddle Dome in 5 years.
Keith, you don't know how math works.
I'm on vacation. I don't need to know math. I am Keith, the host of We Talk Comics, though. And I am joined by, we're going to go around the table, please join us in a half hour when we get to a topic.
Well, I'm going to be fast. I'm Brett, another host of We Talk Comics.
Mo, co-founder, We Talk Podcasts, and just here to be a fly on the wall and to fix Keith when he screws up.
And I'm Chris Beck. I'm a co-host of We Talk Comics.
My name's Stephen Charles Rosia, comic book writer and illustrator, young and aspiring.
And a guy with a really long name.
I'm also an Esquire. I forgot to mention that.
I'm Taylor Stuff. I'm an illustrator. Published but unseen as of yet, but hopefully that'll change in 2015.
Oh, I'm Chris Peterson.
Are you sure?
I draw comics now all the time. Do I name the comics, or do I just like...
Yeah, sure, name the comics.
Whatever you name.
Sell your crap.
Why are you asking
What
him?
Do you draw? I didn't know how much we were like supposed to talk about.
Don't stuff. Make my mistake.
You could have said
Say
like four
draw.
Comics by now.
So I did Beat Vixens from Mars, and now I'm doing Blood Lagoon as a sequel for Dark Horse, Mayday for Black Mask, Incidentals for Lion Forge. I know there's something else I'm missing there. Upcoming project with Boom. So there we go.
Cool. I'm Jason Memel, the writer and publisher of Fight Comics.
All right. Nick Johnson, artist of the webcomic Wolf Hands.
Justin Higgs, writer of said webcomic.
I'm Scott Kowalczyk. I've drawn... Batman 66, Intrepids, Downset Fight, some Steph Peroni, so on.
I'm Cam Heaton. I draw Futility. The end. So,
so I'm Karen Miller. I write Where She Walks.
I'm Nathan Miller. I draw Where She Walks and color Futility.
Rick Overwater. I write and letter Futility.
All right, welcome.
Like as long as you thought.
Yeah, I was expecting more time to prep.
Yeah, you're up.
We did it.
So it is, depending on who you ask, either the end of 2014 or the beginning of 2015.
By the time this is up, beginning of 2015.
So in the grand history of comics, when the giant tome is written, how will 2014 be summarized in one sentence?
The year I finally read the best of 2012 and 2013.
Yeah. I'm trying to imagine that written up. The year that Rick Overwater read.
That's how it works. My best of is always everyone's previous year's best of. So.
I want every like forthcoming year to involve Rick's name somehow. 2015, Rick Overwater had a shower.
Well, dude, you actually, that's 27.
Plays the long game.
Yeah, I had one last year.
What was the biggest comic story the past year? What had the biggest impact?
Comixology?
The Amazon purchase?
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
That's how big it was. It's because I'm a communications major, but I thought the level of internet outrage, you know, and resulting dialogue, which was the big part of it, see the app up this year. Maybe I just started paying attention this year.
It was a year of internet, and outrage has always been around, but I mean, it's faster now.
Yeah, but between that variant cover, Spider-Woman, and there's a bunch of things.
Black Cat.
And that Avengers appearance, which I never read.
That's every year, though.
Yeah, so maybe this is the year I'm paying attention. It's the year I finally got, like, you know, all the comic websites into my feed and stuff like that.
You poor bastard.
Yeah, Twitter, yeah. It's why I wanted to get out of the band scene, but, you know, I'm in the comic scene, and I want to deal with all these people upset over all this shit anymore.
I'd like 2015 to be the year that nobody complains about shit.
Yeah.
can that be the New Year's resolution this year?
That can be done. Just turn Twitter off.
I did turn Twitter off. Everybody still goddamn complains.
You know, one thing I noticed this year was the talking about conventions, like about the role of conventions. What is it, Dave Dorman's wife? Is that the guy?
She's one of them, yeah.
And then someone else. Oh, crap.
Ty Templeton for really recently.
There was another artist whose name I'm forgetting, but they were basically saying, like, the problem with conventions is fans and costumes, you know, that it's become about cosplay and celebrities and not about people buying stuff at tables. And what was interesting about that to me was that it's like, on one hand, is it like, there was outrage there, but there was also very much like, the question of, like, what is comics' business model currently going, or, like, how does it interact with its fans, which I thought was interesting. And, like, you had some creators saying, yeah, you know, I'm tired of people walking past me and buying a Deadpool cover when I'm trying to sell my original stuff here, you know. But on the flip side of it is saying people are there because they're enjoying it, so don't hate them for being there because they love the medium, you know. So I thought that was kind of an interesting new story in 2014. And it seemed to crop up a couple of times.
And it's something that I don't think is resolved. I mean, there's also the role of the Wizard World model of convention. I mean, Wizard World is now a bad word in convention circles amongst a certain group of creators, because they are so focused on the for-profit model of conventions.
I want the word wizard to just be a bad word. Oh, baby, what's up with that wizard of yours? It's bad so now.
The way you say it.
Yeah, you did it. You did it. We rang out 2014 the right way.
There's a wizard staff joke here somewhere.
No. It's too far, Jason.
For 15 years, it'll just get flipped on its end in the way that bad or badass is now. People will be like, dude, that's so wizard. So you can't win.
God, I'm leaving. I'm getting out of this conversation.
That's so wizard.
Well, we've got a lot of people here who sell at conventions. What do you guys think? If a person passes you in a costume, are you more or less likely to try to sell your stuff to them?
Well, no, people in costumes don't buy at conventions. Typically, they never have. Because they don't have anywhere to put the shit that they buy.
They're to be seen, kind
of. Yeah. I mean, they're part of the culture, so they're there. They're there whether anybody likes it or not. But I think that the actual convention model for a lot of creators has to change. There's one... The only guy who I've ever seen do the convention well is Jim Zubkovich, because he actually will stand and sell his product. He will be at his table, and he's a salesman. And I don't mean that in, like, sort of any, like, you know... I don't, there's no preconception to that. He's selling a product. And I know for myself, I will sit at a convention and do commissions or just sit and draw and be, you know, bored out of my mind doing it. But watching Jim, he's always just full of life and just bursting and selling. And he'll order, you know, boxes of books and he'll sell them usually every convention. Jim, if you hear this, I hope that that's relatively true. And I think that the model of the convention for the creator needs to change. I think that we approach it as people, there's always going to be a consumer to buy, that we, the seller, don't have to sell. I don't think that's the right model, personally. I think that we do have to sell, and we do have to consider ourselves in sales the same way a retailer is in sales. You know, I've had this conversation before, I think on this podcast, but the retailer model is a little bit outmoded, where the expectation is that there's always going to be fans coming in to buy books. But if the fan market is dwindling, and it has been for years, why is that market of retailers not trying to sell and push the product more? Because retail is sales. And the same holds true to conventions, I think.
In fairness, though, too, Scott, as far as cosplayers go, I have known quite a few of them. And what they actually wound up doing when I was around them is taking off all the kit and then going and shopping after.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Like, they actually, they would have like huge bags worth of stuff.
Is that they'll browse while they're walking around in their costumes to find what they like, and then they'll take that day off, like on the Sunday or whatever, and then go and buy all the stuff that they had found during those 3 days. So being friendly to them, or however, on those other days is a big push. Even though they're not buying it that day, they may, you know, still come around the next day just because they're not buying, because they're in their Psylocke uniform or whatever, something like that. So
there's probably always going to be exceptions, you know, exceptions to the rule, but I think the actual model that we're working within isn't quite right yet.
Yeah.
We've been working as amateur salespersons at conventions with absolutely no basis for understanding of what we're doing or why we're there. We just kind of show up and we have stuff on our table. And I think I think the entire model, like, I think somebody actually needs to sit down and draft up why we're there.
I know I'm terrible at it. I
know you're terrible at it,
too. I can't sell stuff. I start fumbling and I just
just draw.
We have to like hawk our stuff. It could be just the quality of the product and its unknown nature, but like we have to actually like get all of someone's attention and actually pitch like all day long and to sell our stuff. And we've been doing okay. You know, they're going away. We had to reorder issue on that sort of thing, but we have to work like every minute we're there. And I had to actually kind of go through this, what you said, but I had to actually rationally reconcile and sit down and think about it. Like, because I'm not into the whole cosplay and fan thing and all that. I've just got no interest in my locker. And I was like, why? And why are people buying pictures of this girl who dresses like this character? You know, at the same time, if the fans are what create these things, and you can never bitch about how people react to your art if they're reacting. And in order to become a cosplay person, you know, you pretty much have to ingest a shitload of like comic art and, you know, sci-fi and stuff like that to get to the point that you're going to sit down and spend 400 hours building that perfect Iron Man costume or whatever. So I actually had to rationally walk through that and go, if they weren't buying comics and if they weren't watching movies based on comics and all this kind of stuff, they wouldn't be here that way. Therefore, Rick, calm the fuck down. Everything's okay. You know, and just try to get the conversation going with them. And so that's what we end up doing. But if they're in their costume, you can't really talk to them a whole lot. You know, to maybe take their picture, but you know,
but
they're showing up and they bring people there, and you know, you need to be in a room full of people to sell a comic. So, you know,
Aaron and I have had a really different experience because we sell Where She Walks for Pay What You Want, which seems at first suggestion like a really bad idea, but kind of takes the pressure out of the sales situation, and it's worked quite well for us. But I kind of want to reference that boredom that Scott was talking about. I find it thrilling when the costumes walk by, you know, it's something to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because like the first people we ever sold to were cosplayers.
Yeah,
but they do the opposite. They'll come on the Friday and do all their looking around and stuff on the Friday, and then they spend the rest of the weekend dressed up, and they're fabulous. They're fabulous. Well,
and for the quote unquote average congoer, the cosplayers are actually part of the attraction.
Absolutely.
You know? So like if you can actually strike up a conversation with a cosplayer, you might get other business from somebody who stopped to see the cosplayer, you know?
Well, the person I hope that's hearing these conversations is the con father, Ken Poole, is it? Who runs the cons. We were wanting to see better creator spaces, like more room for local creators, more exposure for local creators. Mm-hmm. You know, do something for the people that are in your city, because that's what it's about.
Yeah. If they had to do one thing to fix my work, so that wouldn't be to diminish any of the cosplay stuff.
Yeah, but to somehow put more of a spotlight on what we're doing, and I like that. That's the business model discussion, right?
Yeah, we recently did a convention that had a bunch of that, but they hadn't really thought about nurturing the comics side and bringing in, you know, a couple brand name guys that maybe Alberta based and willing to make the drive that have actually got some, you know, like B-Vix from Mars or Trevor's, like a title that's, you know, moving some numbers in his red and stuff, like just something to go, oh, that guy's there, so that they'll walk by the other nine comic tables, you know, and that sort of thing. And I think the only real fix is maybe to think about the integration. Just sort of just step back, okay, you know, this is going to a new thing. And we just need to step back for a second and we've kind of let comics slip a little and rethink how we're going to integrate that back into what the new model is, you know. So at the end of the day, you can't complain about people that are willing to buy a ticket and come down, you know, and if they want to wear, you know, their costume all the time, those people are going to bring people into your room for you. So I think, you know, the only thing you got to do is just think about space for the creators and just remember what starts that.
Well, and I've heard
it's a back end fix.
I've heard good things about the New York Comic Convention as well in terms of how the actual floor is set up, where Artist Alley is something that still exists, because I don't think Calgary or a lot of other conventions have something that's specifically Artist Alley where, you know, you're just funneling people in to meet artists.
Yeah, New York has a separate building.
Yeah.
And it's cool that, like, it sounds detrimental, but it's actually cool that way because, for one, and this is not against cosplayers, but there's less cosplayers in there because, it's, for one thing, bigger costumes can't fit through that area.
It's intentional.
I mean, they're all out there, just outside doors and stuff like that. But you get the people that are looking for all the art and all the comics and stuff like that. And then you'll see cosplayers that have more minimal costumes walking through and stuff like that.
Yeah, see, and I think that's interesting. I read an article about a company that tracks customers within a retail setting of when they enter the store, what they gravitate toward first, and then tracks their foot pattern throughout the store afterward to then create a set of numbers and statistics that the retailer can thus use to reconfigure the store to become more attractive to their key demographic. And I kind of think that that's probably something that comic conventions don't quite have yet, because it's really just, you know, with a few exceptions that I've seen, it's really just a mass of people kind of jammed into a spot with sort of no rhyme or reason as to why they're here or why they're there.
Well, one thing about the New York Con, I wasn't there this year, but the year before, but I thought was interesting was that it felt like there was a really democratic mix of who was where in the convention. Like, you know, David Lloyd is standing there working on his new like anthology web series. And then like next door to him is somebody who's just starting out, you know, and they paid their money for a table kind of thing. Or like David Mack, you know, and so there was big creators, or relatively big creators that just by trying to get to them, you're going to see everything else.
I think New York probably has the best setup because for one, the Artist Alley is just mixed. There's no special areas for special guests and special, you know, here and there. You'll find like, you know, this guy, big guy, this guy, little guy, middle guy, you know, and it'll go through the whole thing. And, you know, like, Adam Hughes is at the other far end of the area, and, you know, and then this guy's at the other far end of the area. There's no, like, cluster where people will get ignored. People will always be going through back and forth. And then same time, outside of that area, there's, you know, where people do cosplay out in the main lobby. The lobby's huge. So people are all out there, and then they're all in the pathway. Mm-hmm. And then they've set up aisles big enough for people to be walking in general areas of the convention. And it's some that we just don't see as much of. Like, it's kind of unfortunate. Like, maybe it's like places like the Calgary Expo or somewhere like that, where special guests are all on one end.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then there's the artist alley that no one goes to because people just skip right over that, right? They're not intermingling in between. And, you know, and I think it's could be psychological as well for even the regular, you know, the artists that are in that alley. They just see this crowd that's over by, like, the special guests, and they feel even less about them, you know, about being there, like, well, why am I even here type of thing, you know? So it's cool to try and mix all that together, and I think that's an important part of it, too, is I don't know what I'm exactly saying. But
New York is somewhat curated, too, though, isn't it? Like, there's a selection process of who actually gets into Artist Alley, though?
There's a little bit of that. They have a little preamble in their thing that says, like, we don't, they're trying to cut off, like, you know, just printmakers and unlicensed makers and stuff like that. Like, I mean, there's still some that come a little bit in there, but not as much as, like, other places where you'll just get, like, print wall people that are just, like, there all the time. And there's no jewelry makers. There's no, you know, belt buckle makers and stuff like that throughout the artist alley. It's all artists and comic makers.
And right,
like
and I think that makes a difference as well. I think, well, and speaking with some larger individuals at the various cons that I've gone to, I know a lot of them wouldn't want to sit next to somebody like that, right? It becomes more of a craft fair than a typical, you know, our comic show, right? So for our shows over here anyways, for Calgary, for Edmonton, for Vancouver, whatever, they'd almost need to undergo that process for that to be a legitimate choice for them. Or that's the thought anyways.
I like that parallel to craft show, like where it's, it really isn't, there's nobody at the wheel saying, you know, these are the people that we should group together because like, you know, at a craft show, you have a huge mix of everything and, because we're in Calgary, we'll just use the expo as an example. I see that there all the time. It's just a huge mix and people are scattered everywhere, which I don't know. I'm not in retail, like with a storefront and shit like that. So I don't know necessarily what works, but I don't know if that does.
And I hate the word gatekeeper. Like I hate to say that there should be one guy standing at the front door saying, no, I don't like your stuff, you can't come, or yours doesn't suit our tastes, or this, that, or the other thing. But that's almost the only way to build a proper business model, right? Otherwise, you can't control the content that you have at the show, so how can you control where somebody sits or where somebody else is going?
But I'd like to know, at what point is that, like, where is their responsibility in this? Because other than traffic flow, they sell out. So, I mean, after that point, do they have a responsibility, really, to ensure that you are in the best position to sell your stuff? I'd like to think so, but
I think that there's sort of a divergent business model in this where I would assume most conventions sustain based on ticket sales and sales of tables, but if the actual sales happening at the show amongst everybody who's selling, like that's a number that I don't think's ever been quantified between, you know, artists, writers, creators, whoever is there. Like, I'd really like to know what that number is annually. Like, you know, if the Calgary Expo, say, visitor number is going up and up and up, is that being quantified in larger sales annually amongst the people who are actually there exhibiting? I don't know. As far as I know, that number doesn't exist.
Yeah, and I don't know how you track it.
Well, that's where I think organization comes into it because you have a huge convention hall filled with, you know, thousands of people exhibiting, and who's at the steering wheel saying this is actually what we're trying to do and accomplish and make sure that everybody prospers, because that's kind of the whole point, right?
Well, I think like Brett's point is that like if they're already selling out, is there any more that they need to do?
They're a
nonprofit organization. Are they?
Yes.
I think it's the longevity, though. So I think there's a couple that we're probably not going to go to again that were younger. And I think they consider it a success because they got numbers and they sold out every booth space. But then from some of us looking inside, it's like, well, it's 10% artistic content. And you're also there as a consumer, right, you know. And it's, you know, 90% people selling Mario Brothers fridge magnets and stuff like that. And that might work for a couple years, but, you know, at some point your community might go, ah, it's a craft show, and quit going. So I think you need to be thinking
about that
mix ahead of you.
Here's
you
a good thing.
What's going to be 5 years down the road.
Yeah. I do market collectives in town regularly with comics and with prints.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I do a market collective, it blows a comic show out of the water.
Really?
Out of the water.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Like, I could walk away with almost a month's salary from a market collective.
People there for
you
art
got
of some
it for
kind,
Christmas,
right?
Actually, from your mother-in-law.
I know. She told me about
it. Lovely.
We steered her away from it.
Yeah.
Guys, are ready. Actually, he's helped me peel it apart. Anyway. But, you know, and that's an interesting parallel. Like, yeah, it's a craft fair, but people will hear what you have to say about it.
They're engaged.
They'll respect
they
it. They'll because sit like, down. They'll talk with you. Like, so, you made this? And you're like, yeah. I made this. Let me tell you about it.
The consumer's there for a specific reason,
right,
which we don't have it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
They're there to consume stuff that people have created, handcrafted and created.
And I know for a fact that that group, the Market Collective, those gals, have put so much work into creating a culture of, you come into this thing, there's a likelihood that you will walk out with something from one of these really amazing artists, you know what I mean, but there's so many amazing people there, but there's everything from the bracelets to toques to... no print walls, interestingly. No print walls. Like, no Walter Whites. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, but maybe there's some balance there.
Well, they could learn from each other.
Something that they could take from them.
Scott Chandler wrote a blog post a little while ago about making comics outside of the comics industry, which is to say, like, getting, you know, doing, like, a young adult graphic novel like he does with, I think, Three Thieves, which is published, I think, through Scholastic or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And then, like, his book, Two Generals, I'm not sure who publishes that, but, I mean, it's, like, he's a working professional comic book creator who doesn't even really think of conventions, as far as I know. Like, I think maybe he gets invited to some, but...
Yeah, I met Scott at WordFest.
Yeah.
Which is a book festival.
Exactly. And I think what you're talking about, Market Collective, and what Scott was kind of talking about there, almost reminds me that sometimes we can sell things to people who are not coming into the comic book shop with the people who will come in every Wednesday no matter what. You know, that we can actually sell these to people who maybe don't care about the comic book industry as we here tend to think of it. Like, we kind of think of our bubble as the whole world, you know. But then you go to Market Collective and you're like, oh no, people are just excited to consume something that you've created.
Mm-hmm. So we've homogenized the product,
in a way, and I think we've confused our community for everything, you know, for the entire market.
You're gonna like this guy's Wolverine, or you're gonna like that guy's Wolverine. That's kind of how
exactly.
I
like it. Yeah,
you're gonna find what you're looking for if that's what you're looking for, and it's not gonna matter who sells it to you.
Yeah, like it's like Pepsi or Coke. You know, that's what we think our choices are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is, that's one of the tensions of, and it has been a tension for shows for a while, cosplayers is kind of the target of this year, but 5 years ago it was Twilight at San Diego. That was what was killing San Diego, was all of the Twilight fans going to it. And I'm sure that 5 years before that it was whatever was the hot movie of that year.
Harry Potter was probably it.
Harry Potter, yeah, because you couldn't get into San Diego because of all the Twilight fans who only wanted to go there for that, and it was ruining Comic-Con. But there is that, like, it's interesting to bring up the Market Collective because it's how much crossover can you expect? I mean, you've got people coming to cosplay, and you've got people coming because Norman Reedus is going to be there. Is the person coming to see Norman Reedus, star of Walking Dead, are they as likely to cross over into buying your zombie comic or your sci-fi comic as someone who is there to look at art?
The entertainment side is kept separate from the comic side here in Calgary. People don't just go to the one side, though, do they?
Well,
they do walk the entire floor.
Yeah, what happens is while they're waiting for their autograph for the next person, they mill around the... They slum it in the comic area to see what else is going on in there and see if they can find a Norman Reedus print. And then they take off to go to Norman Reedus to get it signed. So if you're selling that Norman Reedus print, then you're making bank.
But every one of these people is a potential customer, even if that's not what they're there for.
I,
if there's something that you have that they want, they will buy it. I mean,
I'm not going to buy a romance comic.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm into.
Yeah, but no, if I sold it to you, if it's one that I made and I was like, Nathan, this is a really good comic, even though it's romance. Yeah, exactly.
You've talked about that a bunch, right? Like,
totally.
Yeah.
What's your pitch? If your pitch is boring and it stinks, you know? Or
totally.
Their intention may not be to buy, but if it's something that they walk by and they go, you know what? I never thought of that, but that interests me.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't believe they're just going to sit there. Yeah, you're always going to have a percentage of that. Every person that's there is a potential customer. It's a matter of how you approach them.
Like, regardless of what they're doing to bring people in, we do want, like, Calgary Comic Con, these big Comic Cons, to keep selling out, because number one thing is for them to thrive, to get people in the door, because we didn't have that avenue several years ago, right? Now there's a venue where you can go and maybe you'll sell 75 comics where you should be selling 150 or 200, but you don't want it to die. You want it to thrive, right?
What I want to know is, kind of from what I'm hearing, is do you guys want it to be that the creators, it's okay if the people selling the jewelry and the print art is there, but you just don't want them beside you.
Yeah.
You want them to have their area, you want to have our area, and you want to have this area over here for the entertainers. Is that what you want, or
Secret.
You just don't want
them there? Well, the New York guys sound pretty good to me. The democratic idea of I like the idea that, you know, they're bringing up, I haven't been to the New York Comic Con, but you can't really bypass, you can't bypass the craft makers, and you can't bypass the comic guys, because they're all integrated together. That, to me, sounds like a good model.
Yeah, maybe deeper integration.
And regardless of which, I have no problem with how people, like, you never bitch about how people ingest your art and how it affects them, right? Wow. So they respond to it by, like, making costumes and all that. That's fucking great. I think the people that put on the festivals just need to think about what feeds that and make sure that they're getting people going by the new comics, by the new art that will eventually grow and become the next thing that feeds the next cosplay. You know, this year, this costume and that costume are big. A few years down the road, the hot new costume is going to be whatever, I don't know, right? And then maybe something's going to transcend cosplay. But if they keep thinking about just keeping these people that are coming for their own reasons to show off their costume or whatever, and just thinking about the artists they're bringing in such a way to get them in front of these people, then it becomes cyclical in nature and it keeps feeding itself. And so you get new artists and new products coming up that will eventually grow to, you know, to that level that's manifesting that kind of fan reaction that cosplay is or whatever. And I think if they just think about that a little more, they don't have to taper down what it's become or change what it's become. I think they just need to think about what created it. You know, what is the, you know, the chicken and egg, you know, to me, you know, egg is comics, right? And that becomes your movies, that becomes your novels and stuff. That becomes your cosplay. I'm just thinking about that a little more, how they want to do that. And there's probably 100 ways you can skin that cat. If they do that, you'll probably perfect the model a little more than it is.
So how does Market Collective in Calgary do it differently than Calgary Expo? Because if we put both on the table and say they're both presenting the arts, that's what Calgary Expo is. I mean, the entirety of entertainment is still the arts. And if you're saying that at Market Collective you do better than at a standard comic book convention, how is Market Collective presenting its product?
It's way smaller.
Yeah. Isn't it like, solely just stuff people have made? Yeah. Like, you go
and
there and it's something.
They're the only comics there. Well, but the,
not always.
That's not
quite
what I'm
saying.
I've only ever seen you guys, though.
That's well, there's been the dude from Him has been there before.
Okay.
And a few others. But yeah, not a lot.
Yeah.
Not a lot.
Is it more the element of surprise going in and not knowing what you're going to find and then, like, oh, cool, a comic?
Yeah.
As opposed to, oh, cool, 3 million
comics.
An
experience.
And then they make an
right.
event and then they promote the
cool.
event. And on the website you go to, here's the artists and then there's your name. And
I think.
Get a lot of traffic from it.
I think, too, like a sort of a fundamental difference. And I mean, we're kind of getting, we might get into this with some of the later questions, too, on some of these concepts. But the Calgary Expo and the, a lot of the big expos, part of what's implicit in that exchange is not just that you're consuming art, but that you're consuming art generated from franchises.
Yeah.
So that
that's
there's
a good point.
Like, you know, Norman Reedus himself is not even as important as the Norman Reedus that was in Walking Dead, you know.
Yeah, would they buy his independent comic if he was trying to sell it while he was doing autographs?
Maybe.
They would.
Yeah.
Not because they care about the comic.
Yeah.
And I say that, and that's terrible to say, but I don't think they would buy it because it's a comic made by, well, they buy it because it was a comic made by Norman Reedus, not because it's a comic.
Right.
Yeah. But Norman Reedus. So then, like, whereas Market Collective is is like, when you say it's artist focused, it's like that's truly it. Like you were going there because people made stuff.
Yeah. You know you're going to make eye contact probably nine times out of ten with the person that made the thing you're getting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know,
so how does the consumer, how does the consumer's mindset change then from Market Collective, you know, craft fair to comic book convention? Because, you know, we could talk about the actual convention and business model itself, but what's the actual consumer perception?
I don't think it's about mindset. I think it's just a different consumer, period.
Yeah.
And I've seen that between different shows, right? The further east I found in the conventions that I've done, I've sold more and more of my own personal creator stuff. And it's because at the shows, people are coming to see the big name titles, like we said, the franchises, and everything other than that is a risk to them, right? They got their money and they want to spend it on their Batman, right? Every dollar that they have to spend on my stuff, on your stuff, is one less dollar that they can spend on another Batman action figure, right? They already know they like Batman,
so
right? That's not a risk.
So the craft of it, as opposed to the convention, is going in with a preconception of what their actual dollar is being worth.
Right. The type of people who are going to these market shows or whatnot are going there for the artistry, right? They're not going there for the Batman.
They
want
to celebrate the
product,
culture they
right?
love. They're not going to buy anything. They're going there to just be part of this big culture they love, to see the star of the show they like and the dress, clothes they like, and hang with the people that are into the thing they're in, and they might not even be that much focused on purchasing anything or checking that out. They're just to be part of this culture and this meeting place for this world, right?
And the crowd is different,
you know?
Between Calgary and Winnipeg and Seattle, I can imagine, is worlds different than what we're seeing here, right? They definitely have different markets, different people with different money and different mindsets, looking to buy different things, looking to make different risks.
Yeah, I think like TCAF and VanCAF have different audiences than the expos have, right? Because the expos have, I would venture to guess randomly, 80% of them are looking for celebrity and general Marvel DC type stuff. And then the rest are kind of looking for other cool things to see, right? And I think VanCAF and TCAF have more of, they're looking for the arts and to see what people, what artists are doing and stuff like that.
So then is the convention model the right convention for the majority of us to be existing within to sell our wares?
Well,
if you can adapt.
Up,
yeah.
Well, how would I say it be, though? For
it's better than nothing, which is what we had before.
Well, the con just took a few minutes and said, hey, here's a spotlight on Steven. Hey, here's a spotlight on everyone, right? And if that happened...
They're
when
lacking the personal touch, I think.
Yeah,
right.
You know,
it's so huge. You
if
can't.
They said, hey,
so
go
that brings up the question again of how responsible are they for us?
Absolutely, and
because
I
it sounds like what they're really responsible for is keeping us coming back by making sure that people come see us, not what we're selling, but just making sure that people come and that we're visible more than anything. We sell, they provide.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I totally
think it's ticket sales.
I don't feel provided. Respectfully, when you look at the creators that are going to be at these things, it's a database list.
Yeah.
You're listed alphabetically.
Mm-hmm.
And I stop looking. You know, I go to look for something. It's a sea
of
names.
Too much. Yeah.
And yeah. It's,
maybe that's our responsibility then. I was having a conversation with...
To say something?
To help each other,
since
right?
We
because
are
some of us have larger audiences than others, right? I was talking with
Scott,
a good friend of mine.
Armor.
Yeah. by the name
that's
of Peter Chikowski.
I'm the asshole.
Batman goes with your name, man.
Yeah, I was talking with a guy named Peter Chikowski who runs Rock Paper Cynic, a webcomic. Not a huge, huge webcomic, but he's got himself a dedicated audience.
I love that comic, yeah.
And we were talking about this year at the Calgary Expo putting together a bingo card of different creators, right? Now, we have those in at our tables and we say, such and such has fantastic art. Here's your bingo card, and it's got 50 creators on it. You have to go around the convention and find each of these guys, and whoever does it first, whatever, will give you a grab bag.
I think they try to do that with the art book that comes out, but people just go around getting the signatures and take off. They don't even, I mean, maybe,
turn into a sale.
Maybe one out of 20 people actually ask what you're doing, like, you know, at the table, but most of the time people just, and that happened both at New York and at in Calgary, but I think they're that's an attempt at like showcasing artists and stuff like that, well, creators, by making those books, but it seems just not quite
latch on. I think.
Well, you know, it would be interesting almost as a somebody who's independently wealthy to pay someone else to do this would be to do sort of a promotion of the comics community at the expo by someone within the comics community, not expecting the expo to do it, like adding that extra layer ourselves. And like you say, like almost like that, taking that bingo card idea a little further, and then there's like a blog and a Twitter handle and a, you know what I mean? And like it's...
Mm-hmm. So I like that point because if we were to take what Jason just said and look at how Market Collective does it, I think what you're saying is how do we integrate the convention with the creator?
Yeah.
Does Market Collective do that? Do they incorporate themselves with the individual artists?
Absolutely, yeah. They do spotlights on the website.
They're active all year.
They round up press for the artists. They do all kinds of stuff.
So this is a synergy of just people working together.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
Whereas conventions, yeah, we have no synergy. We have a bunch of individual people and publishers all
working.
Yeah,
because you're also starting in like a $500 hole unless you're a guest in order to get a table.
Yeah, what does Market Collective cost?
About
$300. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that's the Christmas, right?
Yeah, it's $300. It's less, pretty standardly, depending on the size of your table. Oh, okay. So you can get like $300 for your basic 6x3 table.
I got a question about it, though. If we all showed up and Market Collective becomes half comic creators,
they wouldn't let it happen.
No, but let's say they let that happen. Do you stop going? Like, does it lose something
while,
for you at that point?
Or you like go less?
Yeah,
I don't think. Yeah, absolutely.
When you say go less, do you mean like the audience would go less, or do you mean like creators would go less?
Creators go less. Now there's too much. Not singled out anymore.
Yeah, you're not. You know,
yeah, but at that point,
you're not a special snowflake anymore.
Yeah, that's
I am a special snowflake.
We all are, but you layer snowflakes on top of
each other. Oh, I'm fine with it. I think it's a great venue. I think anyone that can should get involved with it.
I think what we're talking about right now is growth. Like, I think that's the point that you're making is, you know, if it becomes primarily comic books based, which I don't think it would be, then, you know, that growth, that will never happen. But what we're talking about right now is growth.
Mm-hmm. If you did, like, something that isn't Market Collective, but isn't a con either, it's just what you guys are doing, but everybody there is doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, just an Artist Alley. There's no con, there's no Norman Reedus, there's nothing like that. It's just Artist Alley.
Yeah.
Do people go to that?
Yeah. Well,
Red and White is sort of an example of that. Yeah. We did as good at Red and White as we did at a lot of conventions.
Yeah.
Although
we concentrated.
See, I found Red and White to be more by these Silver Age books.
I do better at Red and White than I do the Calgary Expo.
I just found it was a little more comic
focused.
You know, smaller number, but people were there specifically to see comics. And the book did bring us... It wasn't a be-all end-all, but it did bring us a few people that we never saw.
The retailers are there, too. Yeah. Are you talking about something without even retailers there?
Yeah.
Well, so one that was at, they used to do in San Diego. There's a separate...
Yeah, there's a few of those.
Just, like, just artists. So,
just
like, image comics type
trickster
idea, right? Is that
trickster,
what you mean?
Yeah.
Trickster, yeah.
There was a trickster going on, that type of thing going on at the exact same time here in Calgary as the Expo. Would that appeal to you guys?
Yes.
Absolutely. I think that'd be great. I'd especially like to see how it goes.
Sorry, what was the question?
It would have to be really close. Like,
if there was a trickster style.
Like on the same site.
Yeah,
like it would have to be either same venue buildings, or it would have to be like...
Close by.
Or across going, what is that, north across that way, like where those industrial buildings are or something like that? Mm-hmm. I don't think people will go any further than
no, it'd have to be in the same neighborhood. But, and Trickster is in the same neighborhood. I think that's in a bar.
Yeah, Trickster was kind of weird. It was hard to find.
Bar is a good idea.
But,
it's in a bar. There's no tables. It's in a bar. There's no tables. It's much more.
Yeah. I think I just found my con. Beer and comic.
But even like TCAP isn't like in a center that you would think you would have a convention in. Like it's
a library, isn't it?
Yeah, a very unconventional space, and people are up the stairs and down the stairs, all, you know.
Just because something's done a certain way for a certain amount of time doesn't mean that's the only way to do it. It's the point.
Has anyone gone to that this year? We got rejected. We got shut out. So you going? So have you been before?
No.
Obviously, as we're seeing here, we have 16 people here.
I
11 creators. We're 12 creators here. And so we're seeing that, I mean, this is, and it's growing here in Calgary. So you guys were all to work together and the retailers will work together a little bit more and a little more communication, so that you guys said, you know, this is what we want from the expo. Where you, if you were to approach them and say, we want you to spotlight us, we want you to do this, we want you to do that, mm-hmm. and you're all going together. If you unionize, is that what you're talking about, though, to some degree? Do you think that that's the only way? Is it difficult to communicate one-on-one? But together, you know, you have more of a voice.
I don't know if we have enough pull as, you know, bringing in the whole Aliens cast.
Well, on the flip side,
I'm not saying you're not going to compete with them, but you're talking about is say we want to take more. Okay, right now they have one person who's essentially bringing in the talent. You know, you need people that are selling the tables, and then they have one person who's bringing in the artists from elsewhere, the publishers, Greg Rutta, people like that in the past year. And that's great. He does a fine job. He's going to have an easier time this year. We won't be competing with Chicago at the same time, so that'll help. But yeah, I mean, if you guys were to say, we want to take more possession of this as our community, more possession of the comic book side, what we want this convention to be so that we can sell and maximize our time there, it'd be good for the convention, it'll be good for you, it'll be good for us. If we have more of a say and we want to do that, we want to take some ownership of the Calgary Convention and the Artist Alley, do you think that's something that's possible?
They'd listen. Based on my personal experience talking to them, they'd listen. They might say it doesn't work for us, or they might say they'd listen.
There's got to be something.
I think that's a... We are responsible for making our own opportunities to some
degree. And if it happens,
we all know that. Right? Yes.
I think it would take probably like a couple big names to say, hey, I'm going to go hang out at the Trickster, you know, type of thing. Right, because that's what happened in San Diego. Mm-hmm. Is people like, you know, Mike Aldridge says, I'm going to hang out over here at the Trickster instead of at the show. And so people then start flowing towards that instead because of that, you know, because they see that. Or
it would have to be done right for sure.
I like that a lot.
Because, you know, if it was like whoever.
Yeah. So we tried to do some of that with Calgary this year. We tried to, we helped work with the Palomino, a nearby bar, to throw kind of an after party and have some comics there and all that. And the Palomino approached the Calgary Con and said, hey, we want to, you know, work with you and be an after venue and we'll do a bunch of stuff and we'll promote this. And they basically told the Palomino, we don't really need you.
Really?
You know, thanks, but no thanks. So we did it independently and printed our own cards and posters, and they promoted all that. And the turnout was okay, and we had live bands and a few comic creators, and we sold some comics at it and stuff.
Beer tickets for comic creators.
And drank a lot. I had never heard of this Trickster thing, but it sounds like our first fumbling attempts to kind of do something like that. And it had mixed results, but I could see where done right it might do something. But I think you also need the support and blessing of the con, which we didn't really have.
Was it on Saturday?
So they had the Vulcan Ale thing, you know, at the same time. We were like, yo, come here, and we promoted it, and the turnout was okay. But we also did a lot of press. Most people that came were people that didn't go to the con, because, you know, and this is something anyone can do.
They called the papers
and said, I know you're doing an interview with this star and Sigourney Weaver and all this stuff. If you want the local angle, and local people, you know, we're putting out a comic too. And so we managed to ride the coattails of somebody so you could get some press and sun and fast forward. Root and stuff like that, and it was a big help to us because I don't think anybody, you know, it was our first, it was issue one, no one had heard of us.
Norman loves, you know, the book.
You can create some opportunities yourself that way, right?
Norman's a big fan.
You know.
So what you're saying, Rick, is use the actual pre-existing community to reinforce.
Yeah, I hope I get some synergy between the two if they'll talk to each other, but yeah, you know.
Kind of shit the bed too, because we asked, what was it, like 7 or 8? Local comic makers to come and do it, and most of them didn't even show up. So
yeah,
there was you guys.
Tired.
Yeah, a little more. The people we were hoping the community would show up and bring some stuff. We had a lot of people say we'll come and we'll have a table there, and they had a table set aside. It didn't cost anything to go, right? You know, I mean, I think it was a cheap place to drink, right? But if the community got behind a little more. To be fair, it was the first time it was done, and on top of that, we only put a tiny amount of time into ourselves. We left to the bar because we were trying to get our first goddamn issue out, and, you know, off the truck in time.
I'm just going to mention, Keith mentioned this at the beginning, first time we did this was a quarter of what we have now, and then it doubled, and then now it's up to 16 people here now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, first time is never going to be, you know, never going to be what you expect.
It's also important to remember that a lot of these ideas can scale. So, like, we don't get a buy-in for a Trickster-style situation for this coming con. You know, yeah. I don't think that would happen anyway. But just like too short notice. But that doesn't to say that we couldn't, that there's like, you know, a blog or a Twitter or something couldn't already be out there, or like the bingo card idea, that there's like there's ways to start to connect the dots ourselves.
Advertise within Lacan.
I just think that the con doesn't have a responsibility. They don't need to have responsibility for us, right? We pay for our booth. What's the difference between us paying $200 for a table or paying, you know, $1,000 a month for a spot in the strip mall, right? Mm. As artists, we're a business as well, right? And we're going there as vendors ourselves, right? We're, I don't know, there seems to be a mentality among artists that, oh, I'm poor, I need somebody to help me, but there's all these avenues. There's no different avenues.
They're not obligated.
I know,
obligated. It just speaks to their humanity a little bit if they step back and
maybe
think about
right. But they're a business too.
But they probably it's not an obligation or argument. To me, it's they just haven't thought of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's. I mean, if they haven't thought of it and nobody's brought it up to them, of course they're not going to do anything.
Yeah, but I guess if they're not thinking about it,
their business is also improving every year. So. Why would we add something else, right?
Yeah.
There's you were saying, like, it's a business, like, what we're doing there is a business. And one other thing that I've really resigned myself to, makes it sound dire, when I'm at a table is that, to be honest, I'm not, like, I'm there to sell, but I'm not looking at it as a zero-sum game of sales. I'm looking at it, basically, I consider if I were to put it in my budget, it would be as marketing expenses.
Yeah,
it's a cost of going. It's a trade show.
Yeah.
Exactly.
One is you want to create awareness.
Yeah.
The guy that walks by your booth 3 years in a row might buy on the fourth year. Like, you know, you have
Assassin's Creed.
People have to see a name. I forget what it is. It was an exam question as a university. People have to see your name X amount of times before they even think about buying you, right? So number one is just to be seen, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you're getting some bang for your buck for just having people walk by and see your name, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and then hopefully, you know, sales is your other component, right? Sales is the means by which maybe you can afford to go do it again.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Sell to that person that saw your name last year, you know.
Exactly.
Well, even Jim's up. I mean, I stopped at his table 3 years ago and bought, you know, all the trades he had at his table. But I just found out he's been at the Calgary Expo every year. And 3 years ago was the first time I stopped at his table. Mm-hmm. So, I mean,
yeah.
And I'm there looking for comics, and I still, you know, didn't stop at every table in the show.
Well, you can't anymore. The 97,000 people right behind you, you know, it's a little claustrophobic in that main building anyway. I mean, the big four is now open to take the overflow.
Yeah, that was a little too unclaustrophobic.
It was pretty quiet, but, you know, I mean, that they could start to use those smaller venues on the grounds to do that, to sort of bring, here's the artists, right? Have the artists in one spot.
Maybe
so.
That's the trickster location.
The Big Four was
exactly,
a good idea.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
just didn't tell anybody that the Big Four existed.
Exactly. And that's,
know?
Again,
group,
that's our
no,
responsibility,
totally.
Right?
Yeah.
But we have our own bathrooms in there, and there's food court. So
yeah, true.
Just saying.
But a lot of people said, we had no idea that this was here. Or we'd go over to the main thing, you know, and get talking to people. I think it was actually Nick who looked at this. Dude, I didn't know there was comics over there, you know.
That's what everyone said when they came
we
in.
Had
we had no idea you were here.
Yeah.
Sigourney was like within 100 feet of me.
Yeah. So, yeah.
You know,
is that what's
allowed
by the
somebody
restraining
her?
I was working on that. I couldn't quite get there. So,
you know, it was Sigourney cosplayer, yeah.
Sigourney! She's probably sitting there right now talking to somebody saying, you know, Nathan Miller was within 100 feet of me.
Yes. He was so
you're
loud.
You're fired as a personal bodyguard.
Yeah. And I've seen his
out of here, Costner. So that was one question.
That was some serious industry deliberation.
No, I think that was interesting stuff there. I think everybody, it's interesting. People can learn a little. Do you want to take a little break and then come back with another one? Or do we want to just flow on? What do you guys want? Anybody need
well, a
bathroom
lot of
break? A little.
For people to just make sure.
Exactly.
I think we're done. We can just go.
One question. We're good. Well, that's a good enough summit. Just
Scott's
call it.
Off to the pub.
Well, goodbye, Qualchuk.
Rick's got the idea.
Steady on.
Steady on?
Yeah,
steady
on.
Keep on going.
Just warming up.
Just warming up. It takes 45 minutes just to get warm.
Well, let's talk about making that, Moe talks about how everyone's a potential sale. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. There's also 97,000 people. And there's a tremendous amount of white noise at his show. Now, Eric Stevenson, from Image made a speech in February, which was one of the many kerfuffles we heard this year. This one lasted like a week.
Spell kerfuffle.
K-E-R-F-U-F-F-L-E.
Kerfuffle.
You got two Fs.
I was going to put three S, but not two. one and then it goes back.
Right. Yes.
Now this was at the top of the year when a kerfuffle lasted a week. Now you can actually have a kerfuffle that is wrapped up completely within one day. The controversial issue of Batgirl, which was controversial, a huge problem, apologized for and forgiven within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. Most people had not actually read the issue by the time everyone had accepted the apology.
I still not.
I didn't see the big deal.
I don't know. What is
the apology?
What was he talking about?
I would have been a little shocked too.
Well written apology.
He led me to believe more than
I was unemployed at the time. I didn't have money to buy comics. What was it?
I would have loved to have read the issue before I heard about the
it's kind of
about the problem because it was like a Twilight Zone-y ending. Basically, it was they've been building spoilers. I mean, if you dodged it up now, congratulations. Because I didn't read the book before I heard the ending. They have been leading up to in a couple of issues, the first couple of issues of Batgirl, that there was someone else that was pretending to be Batgirl. And in the third or fourth issue, I guess, of the new series, they never actually relaunched. So the third or fourth issue of the new run, with the new creators, she meets the person, but it's a male visual artist, a performance artist, who has been dressing as Batgirl, taking photos of himself. So this became a problem. This was immediately... It's a trans individual, or someone who is, it's a man who dresses as women, and you have fed into that negative stereotype of the trans community.
It's reinforcing transphobia, and I get it. I obviously can't say on a first-hand basis why it would be offensive, right? I've never experienced that, and I think that's the big problem. Everybody here is saying, "Oh, I don't get it." But we're also a room full of white males, with the exception of one, who are all pretty on the level.
Yeah, we've never really had a bad day in our lives.
Bullshit.
Let's face it. We've never faced real hardship. I know I have.
The thing is,
the trouble I have seen.
Sorry. We approach everything from such a zealot mentality of we self-identify as something so strongly and so firmly that as soon as you're presented with an edge to grow and work against, it becomes a bad thing. We self-identify everything that isn't us as bad. So, you know, I was a very zealot vegan for a number of years and was angry that people ate meat and was like, what the hell is wrong with you people? It's crazy. That's because that's why
I hate vegan.
So. See, that's the thing. And there's a huge community within people who eat meat who hate vegans. And it's just like, all it is us trying to self-identify as something. You have the trans community, and I know people within the transgender community who self-identify as that. So in my perception, we're over self-identifying and assuming that everybody is going to see us how we identify ourselves. This is a kind of a big psychology talk of ego versus id and the presentation of, you know, the social structure of being. But really all it is just...
Well, no, all the listeners.
No, I'm also speaking to an occupational hazard, too. As creators, a bunch of us can't be anything other than white guys. But you can't just write about just you. If you're making good art for the people, you can't write just about your world and your mentality and your kind of people in your life. So you got to branch out. Sometimes, despite your best efforts, you're going to stumble into a gray area and possibly push buttons you didn't know existed. That best you can do, and I did read, like, I work in the communication industry, and the only guarantee of the communication industry is to work for somebody that pisses people off, right? And so the art of the public apology is part of what I write for a living. And so I read the Batman Apology, and the best you can do sometimes is take a shot at something. you know, try to have your eyes open and, you know, and not stumble in these areas and hurt anyone's feelings. And if you do stumble in an area, to step back for a second and say, okay, I'm listening and I'm sorry, you know. Otherwise, to play it safe, you just got to write about straight white guys your whole life, right? Who the hell wants to read that?
So,
you know,
not to, I think this is an interesting subject and I'm happy to stay on it, but did you bring up the Batgirl Keith's subject specifically to go into that, or was it because you were talking about the Eric Stevenson speech?
No, I was going somewhere else, but this is far more interesting.
What was the Eric Stevenson speech?
Well, I'm done. Let's go back to that.
What was the Eric Stevenson speech?
He gave a speech to, it was retailers, on the importance of the direct market, and it was about new audiences, which is the portion I wanted to talk about. One of the things was about what feeds new comics readers, specifically Saga is one that he mentions, Rachel Rising, Fables, Love and Rockets, also the growing number of women reading comics. So there's a vast and growing readership out there that is excited about discovering comic books. But as long as we continue to present comics to the world as the Biff, Bang, Pow context of Marvel and DC, with shop windows full of Spider-Man and Superman, we will fail to reach it. The biggest problem with comic books is that even now, even after all the amazing progress we've made as an industry over the past 20 years, the vast majority of people have no idea whatsoever about how much the comics medium has to offer. As an industry, we still cling to the short-sighted and mistaken notion that presenting ourselves to the world as Marvel and DC, as superhero movies, is the key to reaching a wider audience, and it's just not.
He says that as the publisher of a third company. I don't have anything to say about that. I'm just pointing it out.
It's a valid point. Like, you know,
it's not like he doesn't have an agenda.
Yeah,
I agree with him.
Good. As do I.
So my other career is in theater, and I was at a theater party a while ago talking to a friend of mine who was really excited.
Jason, can I pause and ask what a theater party is like? Like, do you guys exit stage left?
Yep, we can only exit stage left. We can enter from the right.
Shit, okay.
And they start singing.
And every time we
show tunes, yeah.
Show tunes.
And they make an enormous amount of Pursued by Bear jokes.
Sometimes we say exunt.
Ooh. There's always one out of control boozer.
Look at my tights.
I'm wearing them underneath. And to be honest, the reason I brought up the industry part of it was that this is an industry that is itself somewhat insular, like that the theater community can live inside its own little bubble as well. And one friend of mine was excited because he reads Saga, and he's like, oh my God, Saga's so cool. His wife doesn't read comics, and what she said is that I feel like I can't get into comics because I don't want to do the homework.
Yeah.
And it's because she feels that if you walk into a comic book shop, she's expected to already know who all these characters are, what their backstories are, how they interrelate, because to pick up any given issue is to be behind on every other issue behind you, you know. And I think, like, for one thing, I told her, well, Saga's not that old, so, you know, you can buy all the trades and just catch up, you know. Or your husband's reading it, you can just read his copies, you know. And the first issue of Saga does not preclude any knowledge other than the page you're looking at. So I think there is something about that. There is something about, I think, readers that have no... They have nothing against comics other than the feeling of possible homework. You know, I think that the word homework really struck me.
Where does that come from, do you think? Where does that perception come from? Do we have Big Bang Theory to blame?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's been around before Big Bang Theory, that problem.
From the outside, it does look kind of like an impenetrable culture, I guess. So do
I remember
hundreds of issues.
I remember starting in the late 80s to early 90s reading comics. And I just picked up comics.
Yes.
I just went
yes.
And like, oh, look, here's another comic. I'll
yes.
just pick it up.
That was,
And eventually I'd go like, oh, I want to see more about, you know, the X-Men. So I went back and bought the old ones. But I didn't feel I necessarily needed to know what was, like, their whole backstory.
Yeah.
And sort of my interest led to me learning more about them.
But, and you got what you needed out of that very first issue. So I was going to say, like, it looks impenetrable from the outside. But if it's a well-written book, you can pick it up, and everything you need to enjoy that book is in that book, right? you'll have some questions about, well, what about his old girlfriend, or who was Gwen Stacy, or whatever. But, you know, that story is going to be self-contained if it's a well-written book.
I think,
but people don't know that, right? You know, we learned that, you know, you just read a comic and you buy another one, and, you know. But I think from the outside, it maybe looks a little bit, you know, foreboding.
Well, I think it also, it's the way marketing is going also, because back then it was like, oh, this is issue 312 of Spider-Man. I, like, you know, they're in. They're already doing comic, you know. But when you, now when you go to comic stores, it's like issue 2 is here again. And then you go there next, and it's like issue 1 is here. And that, and just, they keep on restarting it every, like, year.
There's
so,
a clear line of progression.
Yeah, so now people go, they see issue 3 of Spider-Man, and they go, well, now I need issue 1 and 2. Do you have it? And they're like, well, no, it's sold out last week.
It's actually the worst of both worlds, because the comic is still precluding that you know all this information about Spider-Man, because even though it's issue 3, it's still in continuity with 400 other issues behind it, you know. So it's the problem of continuity with the problem of numbering.
Well, I think the problem is people see that, like, oh, this is part of a series, whereas before it was just like, you know what I mean by series, like, is it's part of like a very mini, like, small series, like, you know, because you see like an Image, and that's, we've also fallen into the whole series and episodes type of mentality, and, you know, making an arc for a trade, so that when a trade comes out, you have eight comics go into that, and so then that whole story fits into there. Whereas before, you could just get like one story after another and enjoy it on its own type of thing, or like maybe two parts or something like that. So it's
the stuff starts, I mean, it's been bleeding in from other parts of culture as well, though. And I just went to see The Hobbit Part 3, I was talking to someone about Arrow. The TV show Arrow, and they said, well, I've never watched it, but I'm thinking of getting into it. And I said, well, really, the first season has its ups and downs. Start with the first episode of the second season, and because I think that's really where it hits its stride. And I could not convince them that they shouldn't start at episode 101. Start at episode 201, and you'll enjoy it more, because the acting wasn't as good. It was a bit rough. So that comes into other parts of culture. But I don't think that this whole starting an issue at part one is a new thing, though. You didn't used to renumber, but I started collecting Spider-Man at big, bold part one on the cover when they were doing Kraven Saga. And I was drawn to the part 1 of 6 that was on that cover. They didn't renumber the rest of the book, but it was very clearly a starting point.
Yeah. We all get in differently, but I just never saw it as a challenge. But now I like looking at the racks nowadays, it's like you have people don't even know what comic it is that they're buying anymore, because they can't find the Avengers comic, because there's either 6 different ones, or they have bigger other titles like Axis on the front of it. And you can't tell that that's actually an Avengers comic number, 63, because people don't see the A anymore. They see the crossover thing. And same with the Sins one. I had no idea that when I saw original Sins or whatever it was called, I missed half the comics I was supposed to be buying because there was original Sins on there. And I thought that's what the comic was. But then it had like Daredevil at the bottom type of thing. And it's really confusing for people seeing, even me as a person who's read comics for 20 years or whatever, still can't find the comics I'm looking for, because they're covered differently, or they're number 2s, or they're all new X-Men as opposed to Amazing X-Men, as opposed to like Uncanny X-Men, as opposed to just X-Men. And I was like, which one was I reading? I just can't remember now. Because they all have Wolverine in them.
And I think, like, just even what you're talking about there, like, I know if my wife will occasionally accompany me into a comic book shop, and she finds them incomprehensible often. Like, that it's so hard to find, you know. I'm like, she's like, why isn't this alphabetized, or why isn't this? I'm like, well, that's actually organized by Marvel and DC.
you know, and then that's organized by the, you know, the mini series that's happening, you know, and this is actually the, you know, Wednesday new release shelf, you know. She's like, well, where do I find this other thing? Well, that's over there. Is that alphabetical? Well, no. It's all like, even to find something that you might be interested in, again, assumes that you know a certain amount just to walk in the door. Actually, a bit of a shout out is Alpha Comics, I think, does a really great job of presenting a lot of their stock in a way that allows a non fan to browse and find things without necessarily feeling like they need to already be invested, just as a store. But I think that's the challenge for, like, in terms of what Eric Stevenson is talking about. I think it's not that the fans should stop getting Marvel and DC, but the potential fans can't even get into the or are avoiding the store to find Saga, if that makes sense.
I'll tell you right now, I've never really read superhero books. I've never done it, and it's just because of that. I don't think I could do enough homework to pick up a superhero book, right? The first, the only superhero book I've got on my pull list right now is Batman, and it's because the new 52 came out, and I said, yay, brand new world, it's brand new, we're starting from point one, I can do this. I don't have to know anything behind that. But that's the only one I've ever picked up, and it'll probably be the only one I ever pick up. And it does feel very intimidating, and I don't know where to go to it. I know enough off of reading Wikipedia articles and whatnot that I can probably bullshit an a conversation, right? And don't test me on that, because you'll prove that I'm wrong.
The fact that you had to go to a Wikipedia article to make sure to bone up on your superhero knowledge.
And that's exactly what it is, right? And that is the biggest problem, because so many people think that comic books are synonymous with superheroes, right? I don't work in the comic industry typically. I work in construction. And whenever I talk about comic books, it's always superheroes to them, right? This is what comics is to people. They don't realize that when you walk into a bookstore, it's a chapters, right? There's a mystery section, there's a drama section, there's this, that, and the other thing. It's just superheroes. That's what comics is. And that's the largest disservice that the industry has ever done. And I don't know who you would claim about that, but that's why I don't like superheroes. I can't get into it
myself.
That
is sort of a Western mentality, though, like that Western mentality of superheroes being the only comic book genre that exists. Europe is not like that at all. I mean, even Eastern Canada.
Or Japan.
Quebec. Quebec has a really rich comic book culture.
Sales don't always reflect that either, though. I mean, it does within the comic store. Superheroes are dominant. But if you look at the New York Times best-selling graphic novels, there's no superheroes on them. Walking Dead is the most well known to us stuff, but I mean the best selling graphic novel last year was Seconds by Brian O'Malley.
Did it sell that well?
But that comes out awesome. As a book from a book publisher too.
Well, this kind of gets back to again trying to that we as creators can remember that the industry of the stores and the conventions is not all readers, you know. And that, like, yeah, if you have a book coming out from a book publisher that happens to be a comic that goes out to all the bookstores, you're going to do better than anything that you could do in all the retailers, in all the comics retailers.
Well, yeah, I mean, the book publisher reach is so much wider, which you guys know, but like, every comic book publisher, they have to distribute through Diamond. So those, like, there's just, I know Monopoly is a dirty word and a shitty board game, but it is a Monopoly. They all have to sign it.
Take that back.
No, I hate Monopoly. I don't take that back.
And talking about bookstores too, you know, like, you were saying, like, there's a romance section, there's a mystery section, and that's the thing. It's like, imagine if we organize bookstores the same way we organize comic stores, where, like, here's your Random House section. Here's your, you know, like...
chaos.
Yeah, and nobody could find anything, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you don't, like... I don't know. There is an onus. I do believe this in the same way. There's an onus on us as people selling our product at conventions. There is an onus on retailers to sell books to...
anyone.
Consumers, like, yeah. You know.
Is it more on the retailers than it is the publishers?
Well, the thing is, there's no interconnectedness. Like, there's a huge distribution chain between the creator and the consumer, and you have so many people within that chain making money off of this system that probably don't really need to exist. I mean, like, if a publisher was set up in an ideal world, a publisher should just be able to distribute from their warehouse. Like, who is it? Random? It's a Random House. They have their own distribution warehouse somewhere in,
yeah.
I think, the South.
You think in today's day and age it would be easier than ever to do that?
Well, it should be, but like we've got stuck in this chain of consumer and capitalism where everybody needs to be working and our fucking population is, you know, going off the map, so everybody needs a job. And it's just, there's a feminine approach to the way the world exists that we don't look at. And the way the female approach to everything is look at everything as a whole. We're not looking at everything as a whole. Eric Stevenson's speech, as good as
yes.
Eric Stevenson's speech, as good as it is very finite. His, you know, his perception of everything is very American, and I love America beyond reason.
America,
but he sees somebody as
America.
A problem.
Fuck yeah.
America, fuck yeah. Mm-hmm. He sees a problem and he, like, he says, okay, this is where the problem is. You know, it's, look at the American media. You know, you put a label on terrorism. Terrorism is what's wrong with the world. So you have to focus on that. Eric Stevenson puts a label on the retailer. Retailer's the problem. Focus on retail as being the problem. It's not holistic. That's not holistic. I mean, follow the fucking teachings of Buddha or the Tao Ching, like, look at everything as a whole. Like, we're segregating one another by placing blame on everyone. Look at what our previous talk about comic conventions. Like, Market Collective is a collective, and apparently it's working extremely well. And why are we not doing that? Because we're set in a perception of competition and competitiveness between one another, where we're always comparing. Somebody's doing better than I am. I'm not doing as well as they are. That's what I have to achieve. If I'm not achieving, I'm not doing well. So everybody's fucking wrong. That's the wrong way to live.
You're sounding very socialist to me.
Socialism is fucking awesome. There's nothing wrong with socialism.
The gap between where you want to get, though, is that the entrenched systems don't want to lie down and die.
No,
right?
The gap is nobody wants to talk.
Yeah,
like they,
but
like
also
we get people who say, "Well, no, this is the way it is, and we're going to stay that way." What we need is actual dialogue between us, the creators, and say the retailers. But the retailers also need to have a dialogue with the publishers, but they don't have connection to the publishers because there's a distributor. You've got this chain of shit that you have to
exactly.
wait through.
Well, my point is, these people don't want to lay down and die either, right? So you're Diamond. We don't really need a Diamond anymore. You could replace it with a database that we could all just register our stuff in, and a comic store could order from that database, and it could be shipped anywhere from the world. However, Diamond is up and running. There was a day when stores needed Diamond because trying to fill a store with talking to each creator, your head would explode, right? But now Diamond is up and running. Diamond employs a ton of people. Diamond is, you know, making all this money. Does Diamond want to wither away and die? No, they're going to keep fighting to say, you need me. Right? You need Diamond, and we're going to keep trying to demonstrate value so that there will always be Diamond. People like us going, we could live without Diamond now, and you could just order on a database, and you could get all our comics from your store, check, 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 check on a list, and the computer's email go out to all our different warehouses and stuff, and it'll all arrive at your door, at your store, the same as it did from Diamond. But Diamond isn't going to go anywhere. So you've got these existing people in the way between the future state that you see that we can move to and the pre-existing state, and that's where
and
get hung up, right?
And that's where the marriage is really tough, because I've been talking to a lot of retailers, and they, for the most part, actually really like Diamond. The reason being, Diamond shipping is extremely cheap.
You can count on them, right?
Well, no, yeah. You can't count on it.
Well, shipping is one of the things.
It is,
you know, yeah.
It is so. It
I mean,
is
shipping is what you would kill you in when you're if you were dealing with 50 publishers or 100 publishers, that is what would kill you.
Well, in the pre-Diamond world, it had, I think it was 5 distributors. I can't recall how many distributors there were. From the retailers I spoke to, it was crazy. Like the amount of money that they save working with Diamond is huge. But again, then we get into the problem of monopolization, which is what we see with Amazon. Amazon has a monopolization of
not even a really a market, just an ideal of consumption, because they've
Amazon
actually
is awesome.
Sorry,
I get trapped in Amazon. It's just awesome.
Amazon's terrible,
but it's awesome in the sense that it's so
can
cheap
I,
and it comes
can
from
I, can I tell you why? Can I tell you why you're trapped in Amazon? Amazon's reason for being. I'm kind of just going off the rails here. Amazon's reason for being is data collection. Amazon doesn't sell products. That's not their actual reason for existing. Their reason for existing is to collect your data as the consumer to create an algorithm that then is able to market to you, the consumer, based on your spending and buying patterns, products that you don't even know exist.
They're doing a good job.
That's great.
No, it's not. How did we not say awesome. That's a goddamn problem? Like, that's crazy
to find things online.
No, but
I didn't know that was out there. That's awesome.
From a market, from a point of view of a marketer, I work professionally as a marketer. It would be fantastic to only spend money talking to people who actually wanted my product. Like,
well, but here's the trick, is that ultimately this algorithm is being generated, the algorithm is being programmed based on input of data, but it's still being programmed by a person, and that person is making choices that might, not necessarily malicious choices, but they're making choices to streamline that algorithm that you as a consumer or that the seller isn't necessarily aware of. So you are essentially saying, I need to trust that Amazon is going to show me the right thing. And I mean, there's also something to be said for the fact that, like, I once, was it AMB Sound when it was downtown here in that big old bank?
Yeah.
When they used to sell music.
I walked up to somebody and just said, you know, I've got $20. I want to listen to something that you think is great. And they gave me the Fiery Furnaces, which was an awesome CD, really weird, but I loved it. I listened to that CD a lot. I still do. And I never would have discovered it myself. And an algorithm, I'm guessing, would probably never have suggested it to me.
Well, I'll build on your algorithm thing and what you're saying right there. I've discovered more creators, though, with that algorithm. Like, I'll get suggestions for books that I would never see in a store and stuff like that. And I'm like, this is cool. And it's cool stuff. And then I discover that person, that creator that did it, which then leads me to finding more of their stuff, like on their own site. So then I go check out their own site and find out more stuff. So, I mean, I know it's terrible. I understand it.
No judgment. I'm not judging anyone. My perception.
But at the same time,
it.
It's helped me discover a lot of new things too, as well. Because I don't get out a lot to even when I'm at a convention, I'll end up sitting by my table the whole time, so I don't get to see a whole lot of stuff.
Can I pull this back a minute? This is where I'm talking about the holistic vision of everything. You know, like the holistic vision of just the entirety of this industry, we have absolutely no vision. Like when you're at a convention, Christopher, as a professional, you should not have to sit at your table for 14 hours a day or whatever it is. I haven't been to a convention in a while.
It's about that.
It feels like that. But like the holistic vision of just the entirety of this industry is I feel like we've just been kind of patchworking it along to such an extent that we find ourselves here where we're saying, not much is working. You know, like sales are down, you know, readership is down, you know, people are not, we don't know how to attract new people into the industry. And we get caught in this cyclical loop of just doing the same thing over and over, but never actually getting to the fundamental of like, yeah, let's just shake this shit up and change
it from the ground up. Part of it, I think, too, is that shaking things up can be hard.
Scary as
you
shit.
You know?
Well, like, I want to pull into something here. You guys are selling, you say you sell your book, folks, pay what you want. That's a different idea. So how did you come to that idea? And how was that, you say it's successful for you. I mean, do you guys think that you're getting about as much per issue as you would if you were charging?
Probably more.
Woo! Isn't that kind of the point?
It averages out to be about $6 or $7 a book.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
outside. That's from thinking outside the box. Thinking and looking at it. That's from looking at it in a way that Scott's talking about. I mean, really. I mean, don't confuse socialism with communism. Not the same thing.
I don't know why you're looking at me.
You're the one who's the invisible hand. I know you have a plan for the Red Menace when they attack. No, it's not the same thing. I mean, you're coming at it from a different point of view. I mean, if people feel like they have an ownership, part of it is the people. They need to feel like they have an ownership of the product they're reading.
Yeah.
And if they feel like that and they feel like they're a part of the success and they're cheering for it, then they're more likely to support it, not just by financially, but also by telling people about it and talking about it. And that is an advantage that is one thing that there's a lot of advantages that the big two have. That's one advantage they don't really have. Mm-hmm. You know, people will never feel like they're part of, you know, Spider-Man success.
Yeah.
And like they're going to champion it in the same way.
Yeah. That's all that I want from it, really, for myself. I want to be part of that relationship with that person who happens to be standing in front of our table at that moment. We've met friends now through being at conventions and stuff.
I'm Devin.
I'm very bad at the pitch. And it could be just that I'm playing to my own strengths. I know I'm not good at pitching, but I can talk to anybody. And I'm interested in talking to people and hearing what they like and what they want to see. And then if they ask, telling them about what I'm doing. And that works for us. It's not going to work for everybody, but for us.
And it still is not it still has its downfalls. We'll sell a comic for 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And you just kind of have to, you know, be okay with that, be happy that it's in that person's hands.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole point, because then hopefully they're going to like it and they're going to come back.
Are you selling pay-as-you-want digitally, or is it
hand-to-hand?
Oh, like you do pay-as-you-want, like physically?
Yeah, okay. In person.
Yeah. I've only done an electronic thing.
We're trying to get that set up now because we think that we've obviously been missing the market and people see it online, but we also, it's free to read online as well.
Yeah.
And I'm consistently working on it, so there's always kind of something to look at that's new and changing with it. So I don't actually know if there's a community, but it seems like there is a community starting around the book, which is good. It's cool. People will come to pick up the new issue and say, I really like the last one.
We had someone at Market Collective come come to the table to tell us that they'd read both books 3 times.
Oh, right.
As a creator, everybody here is a creator. I mean, is the point of what you're doing, is it to make money or is it for it to be read?
I want to make a living doing what I'm doing, but there's a certain joy that comes from it. It's like when I'm at a convention, right? Going back to the convention thing, I feel like I'm selling a piece of my soul every time somebody picks a Batman off my table. But I feel great when I sell my own book, but I make almost nothing off my book, right? I make pennies compared to the hundreds of dollars I'll make off of superhero prints. And these superhero prints might have taken, could have taken me 4 hours, could have taken me 2 hours to do something quick that I can whip off that I know that will sell. But the other thing, I had Keith come to see me in Edmonton, and we were talking, and that was cool, that was neat. Somebody picked up my book, and they wanted to come in and say, hey, I picked up your book. That feels good. But I also want to put food on my table and have a house to sleep in, and
you want your cake and eat it too, isn't it?
But there's an understanding, though, that we all have, that when we got our first job, that it was the bottom of the rung.
Yes.
And I believe comics are different that way, because you very much can kind of make your own way to a certain degree if things go well. You can set it up. You can dream that it will go how you want it to go. But you still have to start with very little recognition. You have to earn respect. People have to see your art. You have to have a community of artists that are providing you feedback on the shit that you show them, I believe. And really, I think the one common thread that we've been kind of kicking around a little bit today is the community, right? What is our comics community here? Is there one? I don't think so.
Yeah, nobody in this room, I get the feeling, is competing with anybody else.
Well, sure, there's a certain guy. I remember talking with Chris about this a long time ago. Right?
It's
but these, Chris and Scott are two guys who are publishing, but are doing monthly books now. Right? Which is awesome.
Well, not monthly.
Not monthly.
But still, that's not a big book, right?
Yeah, but the thing is, I think
your perception on this is very different.
Like, totally.
And I like that.
Yeah.
And because you're coming at it with an expectation of, as an artist, rather than, I don't even know what the
capitalist
maybe.
Be very happy to make some money doing
it. Sure, yeah. Well, about that, as we all would.
Yeah.
Connection, though. You know, you're talking about the, we're talking from 30,000 feet a little bit ago with this big, dense, penetrable industry and this ideal model and all that kind of stuff, and it's overwhelming. But the thing is nothing can stop you from making a book and then just telling as many people as you can. I think most people at this table, you start with, God damn it, I want to make a comic. And so you make it. Step two is, I'm going to try to actually sell it and create a business model and handle this as much business acumen as I can, because that will help me, put me in a position to sustainably continue to do what I want to. But it starts with, I want to make a book. And nobody can ever stop you from doing that and just starting to tell people about it. And then, you know, part of your brain, you know, okay, now how do I do this in such a way that I could pay for the issue two? You know, can I sell enough issue two to actually be able to print issue three? You know, and unfortunately, luckily, nobody can stop you from doing that grassroots thing.
Nobody
can stop you. On the other hand, the act of doing it does not...
your wife can stop you.
Your wife
can. That's about it, yeah.
But the act of doing it also doesn't necessarily guarantee you or it mean that you can then demand an audience pay attention,
yeah.
Right? You know,
no, none of us is entitled to an audience or sales in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Right? Uh-huh. That's why I personally think it has to be about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be.
I was going to say something. The notion of you guys doing the pay what you can at mm-hmm. the table. I think that's fascinating. Actually, I haven't considered that. I give away Fight Comics online for free.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason I charge for, not the only reason, but a reason I charge for the print copy is because it costs money to print. You know, more money than it does for me to host the thing online. But
I got one of your comics about a book.
Yeah,
I'm willing to pay for that print experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and for me, if I'm going to take in a print experience, I feel like I'm going to reward or, you know, like match the value of what I'm getting in terms of the cost it took to provide it to me. But I think that the notion of and this is kind of maybe going in that socialist route as well. But that notion of digital distribution, giving things away, for me, I think any given day, people who are not reading Fight Comics are people who have never heard of it, not people who got it online for free, you know, and then decided not to buy a copy. Like, so
there's a double-edged thing too. I mean, Steve used the phrase gatekeepers, and gatekeepers are good and gatekeepers are bad. Often the phrase is used as the person who holds people out, the person that, you know, our comic stores are gatekeepers, and they give this perception that comics are impenetrable. But there's the good level of gatekeepers, which is what Chris is talking about with Amazon. Amazon's absolutely one of the top gatekeepers right now, and what they do is filter this ridiculous mass of content that's out there to something that's actually relevant to interests you have. The comic store also does this, but they can't stock 50 copies of every comic. So if they, you're reading Saga, you might like, that list is going to be limited to what they actually have in stock. And yes, this stuff's out in the world, but who tells you where Fight Comics is? Like, who's that gatekeeper that actually tells you, here's what you can really accomplish reading in the time you've put aside. Here's 10 webcomics. Here's 10 things you have access to.
Is this part of the problem then? Is this actually part of the significant problem of the fact that we've set up gatekeepers and have accepted that there are gatekeepers like comic book shops, like publishers, anyone who has any sort of influence within the artist world then is, you know, on a pedestal that we then have to climb to actually rest upon, is maybe the market collective notion of just it being something that just happens to exist for
apparently
a day.
Apparently there are gatekeepers.
Well, those lines,
but the market
blur.
Collective also has a gatekeeper.
You're still
though.
Paying to get into there. And
look,
we
could shit over every single idea and go, none of this is going to work. There's always going to be a fucking gatekeeper. But until we say, isn't there maybe a different model than the one that we are actually structurally used to, which is in, and I'm not terribly fond of Alberta, but the like the notion of
welcome to the Calgary Comic Con.
But the like the Alberta experience of consumption is, guess what? It's Saturday. I'm not working my 10-hour shift today. I'm going to the fucking mall and I'm going to buy something.
Yep.
And the mall becomes the actual structure of the gatekeeping of consumption. And it doesn't work. Like, is it a pleasurable experience? You go to the mall and come out and going, woo! Like, that was the most fun I've ever had in my life. Never. That never happens. You never see a happy person come out of the mall. Like,
I do because I exit from Toys R Us.
But you get cracked anyway.
Those lines are going to blur, too, right? Amazon, not to drag us back into the freaking Amazon quicksand again. On one hand, they're like this 400-foot wall. On the other hand, I'm going to put out a 50,000-word novella this year. I just finished the first draft.
Steampunk.
I'm going to hire an editor to make sure it's actually, like, you know, clean from beginning to end and all that kind of stuff. Nobody can stop me from putting this book out. I don't need an agent.
Yes,
I don't
but
and all that. And 10 million people could read it. 5 probably will. But you're
still working within the convention of how to actually distribute that to a mass of people who want it.
But at least that forum is there, right? Where it wasn't there before.
But what I'm saying is, do we need that forum anymore?
Well, this is the tricky thing. Is
well,
that
the
like,
death of the bookstore, you kind of...
Because I have stuff online, too, and I get maybe 3 views a month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the difference, right?
I think this feeds back into a cyclical problem of saying, well, it exists, and it can do this for me. Does it ever? I don't know. I've drawn Batman and it hasn't exponentially changed my my profile within the industry, but I drew Batman.
It could be as creatives, we're not naturally wired to be the best people to solve business problems.
But we're assuming that we don't have the answers that like a business person does. We're wired with all the exact same answers that anybody else in the world has. But what we have is a societal structure of existence that we've accepted to be normal.
And Scott,
I'm not
I want to say, you know, you're right. We don't need malls anymore. You know why? Because we have Amazon. So
how long were you holding on to that, Joe?
I could just see this energy coming off.
This is 501st podcast.
There's a lot of these. Yeah.
Actually, with something to like talking. You know, so you've got a book you're releasing now. If say it would have been harder to get it into Chapters, you know, or into an indie bookstore or whatever.
Well, it wouldn't even get into Chapters without an agent and a publisher.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes, which are gatekeepers
and exponentially more expensive.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
possibly more profitable. Sorry, we're cutting off.
Yeah. Leaving aside the extra effort, the higher difficulty involved in getting on the shelves there. The one nice thing I find about like if I'm looking for music and I go to HMV, I'm generally looking in. Like I know where to find the genre that I'm looking for, so like, and it's same thing in a bookstore. Like if I'm looking for, you know, poetry, it's over here. If I'm looking for fantasy, here, science fiction, here, you know, that kind of thing. What is nice about that is that it allows for the synchronistic discovery that you could never have predicted, where you see the book that's next to the one that you were going to buy, you know, and you look at it for a moment and it interests you just enough, you know. Or it's got a cover blurb from your favorite writer, and then you go, yeah, okay, I'll trust that, you know. And then you buy it. You make those discoveries, and that's I think what being on Amazon or being like having something online, what it doesn't give you is that like wherever Fight Comics is on in the Bluehost, you know, server farm, I'm not getting any next door traffic from the website that's being hosted right next door to mine. It's just like the only way somebody's going to find that is through. Well, like through Googling or through, but they have to be looking for it. They're not going to stumble upon
people
it.
People that bought eVixens also bought, you know, that's the best you can hope for, right? Is one of those.
Exactly.
Kinda,
yeah.
Comixology. Sorry, I just keep picking that. You're right across the table, Chris.
Comixology does actually.
Yeah.
Do
they?
Yeah. When you purchase something, they tell you people will also buy it. It's not as smooth as Amazon's yet, but it is there.
I've never noticed it.
But again, That's a function of the gatekeeper that's doing that.
Isn't it nice, though, that we have the comic expos and the cons? Because if you think about it, like books, you know, authors go to bookstores occasionally, but as a very small author, you're not going to get the chance to go to that many bookstores. Whereas, I mean, at least with a convention, I mean, with music, you have concerts and stuff like that. But a convention, you know that there's going to be a place. to sell your product.
Music's a good analogy for what's going on in comics, because I was told 15 years ago when, you know, Napster was around and, you know, you could start selling your music direct to people online, that music stores were going to disappear. And to some level that has, because of the changes in distribution, but that record companies would disappear because the artist would no longer need an intermediary between themselves and the person buying the music. And that hasn't happened. And that's, you know, Rick was saying earlier, they don't want to go away. So they've kept the relevancy of what they do.
I think it's broken apart.
Curate artists that, you know, people want to see. Sorry, you're a star.
No, I think it's broken apart a bit more.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, that's the only part where you sort of can't equate, is because people still see Marvel and DC as a name, and they'll see Image as a name, but they won't see Peterson Comics as a name, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, but so people are more likely to buy an order. Like, even if you look in previews, for example, it's hard to find anything past IDW, Dark Horse, Marvel, and DC, and Image.
Retailers don't even look past that.
Yeah, and but with music, you're looking for the artists, whereas comics, you look for usually it's the company and then title and then possibly depending on the creators. But sometimes I don't even know Image is doing half the stuff that they're doing. Like,
so what you're talking about is the consumption, like the experience of the consumer.
Yeah, well, and this is like what you just said there, and I know I keep harping on this, but what you listed for previews is like Marvel, DC, Image, IDW, Dark Horse, not mystery science fiction. Mm. You know,
well, the thing is, everybody can distribute nowadays, but not everybody should. I mean, let's face it, some stuff out there isn't very good. So as a consumer, when I see, if I know a book's coming out from Image, I have a certain level of trust that somebody who is an expert in this industry, who knows good storytelling, has looked at it and said, that's worth me publishing. And less so for Marvel and DC, because they're properties. But for Image or Boom or one of these ones, these books, I trust them. Now, it doesn't mean I'm not willing to pick up an independent. I pick up a lot of them, and a lot of Comixology submit. And especially if they're, you know, $2 or something like that, or a dollar. I mean, it's easy to get in there. But yeah, I mean, let's face it. Like I say, I don't think just because you can do a book or write a book and distribute it now doesn't mean you necessarily should. Not everybody. Yeah, not everybody's meant to do a product, and it's not everybody's going to have something good.
I'm a big free market guy. I think everybody should make something and then let the piranhas decide what they want to eat.
But right? The public will always figure out what it wants.
Sometimes the piranhas are eating the easily digestible stuff.
You're right.
You know what I'm saying? Like. It's more of a chance that a terrible Spider-Man comic will be sell 10,000 than a good, you know, independent comic that sells 200, right?
No, and you're right. Everybody should make. I'm not saying they shouldn't. I'm just saying, man, I'm sick and tired of reading stuff that's crap.
I think that you said something that was interesting, Mo. You said that you place a certain degree of trust with them.
I trust if I see a book that's coming out now from Image, I have a certain degree of trust on it.
But as the consumer, mm-hmm. part of what you're doing is farming out your experience, mm-hmm. your experience of experiencing the art, the, you know, the experience to somebody else.
Really, like, soak it up.
I know. I'm just thinking as much out of that word as possible. So you as the consumer aren't actually experiencing
what
everything.
What I'm saying is, it's not necessarily a bad thing for there to be an editor. Not necessarily a bad thing for there to be somebody in there who can focus a story, can focus a writer, can focus an artist, and bring the best out of them. I mean, I don't want that to be, like, I'm not saying this necessarily has to happen all the time, but, I mean, there's not a lot of people out there that are going to be able to do the best story they can do by themselves without having somebody who's going to sit there and go, you know, you're making an error here, and this is what you can do to improve it, and let me tell you why, and I'm not doing this to try and take away your creativity. I'm doing this to try and help you focus and be the best you can be.
Well, what's fascinating is you've just described a process that Image doesn't use.
That's the thing I like sort of was about to touch on.
Yeah.
Was
Chris was going to touch on so much.
Sick freak.
Grubby fingers in.
With him, it's funny that he get that the speech is given about that when Image is probably one of the most open. Like if you're making a comic, you have no control over, like I mean I should say you have control over everything, but there is no influential control like marketing, editorial or anything like that that helps you sell your book. The only way that
other than having that big eye, which means a lot.
Yeah, but I don't. I don't see lots of books like the Image chooses. The way I see it, I don't know if it's true, but Image chooses what they want to promote or not, and really they don't have to. They don't have to promote anything. They want to make money, so they have no.
Image does not make more off of a book that sells more. Is one of the biggest things that people don't understand is that Image gets a flat rate off of every book it sells. It doesn't get more if the book sells more, so it doesn't have a horse in the race.
So the opportunity to fall on your face is a little more.
I don't know.
Relevant.
That's
and that's, I've been earning, paying the bills as a writer of one kind or not my whole life.
They get a flat rate for each book,
and it's pretty awesome having an editor. Books, like you know,
they're making the same off of something that's selling 5,000 copies as they are off of Saga or Walking Dead. They get this flat rate.
Yeah, they get a certain percentage. I mean, I think I keep on hearing that, but I got to think
you gotta experience it.
They got to be making a little something more off of like those books that are like after a certain point.
Yeah, that sounds like a terrible business idea.
But
I thought they had a ceiling though. Don't they have a sort of? I listen to a podcast. Don't they have a certain burst through where if you do cross a certain line, they get an additional amount or something like that? Like
who's read an Image contract?
Yeah, but like anyway, what I'm getting at is that
no, there were no contracts. No.
Editors at Dark Horse or editors at Boom or whatever will help you create the best book that you can create or you know like focus you and guide you. Whereas independent comics that you don't have any type of, people say that they don't like editors, but at the same time, they've helped a lot with like books bring out the best in it.
Thank you for doing it more eloquently. That's essentially what I'm saying is I just don't think that necessarily this idea that all publishers are evil, which I just felt like we were kind of going in that direction. I don't think that's necessarily the case.
I don't think all publishers are evil, but I think like I think there's a...
My publishers are lovely. I'm putting that on the page.
I love every publisher that I work with.
I love my goddamn editor.
There you go.
I think the publisher at their best does everything that the creators shouldn't or don't have to do. Like, which is to say, market the book, figure out where to print the book, like. You know, that's all this stuff that I do with Fight Comics that, like, I'd be more than happy if somebody else were to do that, you know.
And bring some experience.
Yeah.
Too. Like, you're talking about the editors. If you're serious about writing, a good editor will help you. Like, I want an editor at all times. Like, I've done this long enough. I've written articles. Now I write big Ponder's reports for the government. I do all sorts of stuff. I make comics. When you get a person you can trust for that outside point of view who's got more experience in the industry, you know, maybe a Dark Horse or wherever, that can be a boon to you, you know.
I don't know.
It's good to have a team behind you if it's the right team and they really have your back.
I think that there's always going to be a perception on the outside looking in no matter what, and you're always going to perceive things to be better. The grass is always going to be greener. It's not. Like, the grass is green no matter where you're standing. It's just, it's how are you perceiving the grass? Are you always looking 8 years down the road, or are you going, well, I'm doing pretty good right now. Like,
You're saying earlier that I was...
Gorgeous? You're fucking gorgeous, Mo. That's what I was saying earlier.
Well, you may not have said it, but we were all thinking. But
my hands do the talking.
Yeah. And you got it. Seriously, next time I'm going to charge you. But
the hell was I going to say?
I mean, DC Comics has this outside perception of being very interfering. Editorial interference is the phrase that keeps getting used about DC. If that were true, how did the Batgirl thing happen? Like, if they were as controlling, I mean, and certainly what came out of that apology wasn't,
it wasn't our editors were fine with this, and that's why we did it.
We were
it
just talking about how gorgeous I am, just so you guys know.
It was
know
like, this was back. The story we were telling, and
so we were talking about the
like, we own that. We own that this was our story.
Yeah.
I think, again, pure speculation, it could be that he has, in his contractually, he has more hands off, maybe.
This is all speculative.
To get back to what I was going to say, when I see that big eye, I don't necessarily mean that that means that I'm going to like that character.
Are we talking image or are you flirting with me?
Just the one eye.
Big eyes. When I see the image label and I see the dark horse label,
there is a certain minimum quality.
Yeah, it's not necessarily that I believe that it's going to. I do believe it's going to be a certain quality book. It may not be the book that I like. I may not want to read it again. But I do believe that at least there's a certain quality there, even if it's not a storyline that's necessarily for me.
I want to use the word a curator instead of gatekeeper because it doesn't have that.
I mean, I read Big Planet number one. I didn't love it. I won't read number two.
Yeah,
you've trusted the curator in
exactly. But I think that's a good book that somebody's going to like.
Go ahead, man.
It's I think too. Like, there's something. I think to be acknowledged. Like, I agree with a lot of your points.
Did you say you hate to be acknowledged?
You did.
Did I?
Yeah.
I am not.
Is that a word on your self-esteem there?
I'm not talking to you.
Is that what I said?
we'll be able to check later.
We're going to all turn our back to you and just say whatever you want.
I feel the need to acknowledge?
I'd like to acknowledge.
Yeah, that's what I thought you said.
I'd like to acknowledge. Let the court record what I said. No,
can you read that back?
I really love that the grass is greener everywhere. Mm. Like or the grass is green everywhere. I like that phrase. And I think it's true, like that, yeah. There's
his wallet.
Is now.
His big greens. Anyway, no.
That's going to be the sub-name of
where
this.
I was, but I think the flip side to that vision, I think, of seeing things completely, sort of, completely holistically and realizing that we can all do anything is that anything also means doing everything, and doing everything takes a lot of time
and
a lot of effort. And that's like it's. I think that there that needs to be acknowledged as well.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, the comic book community it is a community, right? I mean, if there's one less cow, everybody eats a little less. I mean, y'all want to succeed, and y'all can do it together. You have to, though. You know, I mean, the idea of competing when you can work together to grow the industry.
That's not the capitalist point of view, though. I mean,
no,
if that were really how it was approached, Marvel and DC would still publish as many books as they did
before.
In the mid-1980s.
What degree? They're the number. They're the leaders. They have what, 70% of the market share, something like that.
Yeah, it's closer
better
to
than
80.
Better than.
Yeah.
So how much of the responsibility to grow the industry is just on them, and do they do enough to grow the entire industry? Because their next talent is going to come from that other 30%. And yet, do they do enough to grow the industry itself? Do they care enough about the industry itself? Or do they just give a shit about themselves? And that's one of the things I see as a big problem is, okay, you have all this marketability, you have all this popularity, you have all this money, and you are only concerned with yourself. You're not concerned with this industry and this community as a whole the way you should be.
Here's my best example of that. I used to follow C.B. Cebulski on Twitter. He's one of their big editors. He does portfolio reviews.
Did you unfollow him?
I unfollowed him because every day he would tweet out something another artist did wrong. Every day.
Wow.
He'd just tweet out, don't come to me with this. Come to me with this. Don't do this. Do this. It got to the point where he came to our expo, was it last year?
Did he actually show?
Yeah.
Did he?
He was here. And I like the thought of sitting down with this man terrified me. And saying, here, like, you almost feel like, actually, if you don't do it like this, we have no need for you. Don't sit down. Don't even get in touch. You know what I mean? And not to say I'm a Marvel artist, but that what I'm saying is accessibility-wise for artists, I think it's more of a terrifying process to take your portfolio in front of one of those people.
Yeah.
But than it is to present a whole story that you've made on your own, present it to someone like Image and say,
What do you think? Do you think there's something
here? Why does he know what he's talking about?
Yeah, I was going
to
ask.
Right? Like, that's the thing. We get to define what success looks like for each of us.
The Disney Corporation thinks he knows what he's talking about.
Well, there you go. And they have to measure it.
But they've been doing this for 75 years.
You're presupposing that that's the only way to do it.
Yes, and then that's equality.
But things grow up in an environment in order because enough people think they're
Spider-Man.
Right.
But this is where I'm talking about the holistic vision of this. If you both are selling books at Marketed Collective and developing relationships with people, that is doing something right. It doesn't need to be classified as right or wrong. It just is. And
absolutely.
It's
a thing
and
we do.
And it sounds
beautiful. It's just it's a thing we do.
And mm-hmm. we can say, the Marvel talent directors or scouts of whatever publisher, they know what they're talking about. They're right. Well, they have experience, but it doesn't mean that the entire picture is right. The picture is how we're perceiving it, and we're mm-hmm. saying, and if what we're saying is, Disney, Marvel, all of these big corporations are always right. Well, BP spilled how much fucking oil into the ocean, and they're the actual professional mm-hmm. in their field. Like, the Shell Corporation is the second largest corporation in the goddamn world, and how many people die in what is it, Syria, over oil consumption and production? It's insane. The assumption that the system that we have now is the right one is what undercuts us, I think, as the artist. The artist is developing. I just went to see I always get pronounce his name wrong, the Jean-Michel Basquiat, Jean-Paul Basquiat, in New Orleans. And it was, the man died at 27, and the work that he was producing, it was an experience. Like, just to stand in a gallery and see it as art, it was just an experience. That was something I took and went, wow, this is what I'm walking away with. I'm walking away with my relationship to this piece of artwork. And if we're saying that the art that we're creating needs to be consumed, and that's the only method of its relevance, I don't know that that's necessarily true. It may be a standard that we've set and accepted for a long period of time, but Cuba also had a dictatorial leadership for decades, which then ended in a glorious revolution in the 1950s. And it's like, that's what the whole world needs. Like any system that's in any state of order for any period of time, it might be right, it might not. But if it isn't always right, well, then why don't we just revolt and try something new?
When was the last time a revolution worked out?
Why is that even a question? That's a revolt.
It worked. Right?
Change is a beautiful thing.
I guess I'm just saying, too, as an artist, like, I don't want what I've made to be quantified by its saleability to that market. I guess what I want to be able to do is create a story, finish a story, much like everyone here's doing. We're making books. That's awesome, right? But
what I was saying earlier, if you just do that,
it's going to
solve some problems on its own.
I feel like I'm a little on the outside then, because what I really want is to be paid to draw things.
Sure, absolutely. Right? Don't get me wrong, man. Don't get me wrong.
Ultimate goal.
But if that's your primary goal, then, and don't get me wrong, I completely understand that to do what you do, you want to get paid. But Jason was saying that the one thing that we don't have is a recognition of the entirety of the work that we do. If you're producing your own book, you're not getting paid to find the distributor. You're not getting paid to be on the phone call to the convention saying, I need a table to produce this. You're not getting paid or recognized. And in our society, recognition is based on a quantifiable number, which we call currency. And that's the only way that we recognize. And in Alberta, boy, is that profound, where, if you're driving a Lexus, hey, guess what? I'm going to recognize you as working, that much harder because you're driving a Lexus. It doesn't mean anything. We have a structure, a societal structure in place that misrepresents what we should be recognizing, which is what we should be enjoying.
Well, and the other thing...
That's interesting.
The other thing, too, is like if the main goal is to get paid to draw... Well, and I mean, I guess, is the main goal to get paid to draw, or to get paid to draw comics?
Get paid to draw what I want, I guess.
Okay,
yeah,
is
that
comics?
Different.
Yeah. No, it is.
Different.
But
you put that secondary to drawing, like, from my standpoint, I only get paid to write. That's mostly because my
secondary goal will support my first goal, which is I want to write more. And being paid to write will allow me to write more, as opposed to cleaning toilets or mowing lawns or pounding nails or whatever I got to do to actually put food in the plate.
And that's the system that I don't understand. I mean, you're saying you work construction most of the time, but you would rather be...
Well, that's the goal, right? I work, 9 hours a day, and then I come home and work till midnight, 1 o'clock on my own stuff because I want to be doing that, right? But there's, I can't go and take some magic course and then come out and magically work comics, right? It, unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. So I got to put in the time somehow. Yeah, but I still got a mortgage to pay. I still have food that I got a fiance. I've got a dog, 2 cats,
Jesus, quit bragging.
I've only got 1 cat.
I got things I got to pay for. It'd be great if I could support myself out in the bush where I grew all my own food. But even then, I have to take my time making all my food. And
I get that. Like, there's always going to be something that says you can't do this, and like that's like Nazi propaganda of the 1940s. American propaganda of today. Like that notion of you can't do because
that's. I'm sorry, Scott. Just so right. Yeah,
keep it in there.
No, but we're. Like,
Scott, I gotta tell you, everybody here, I'm gonna announce it publicly. Man, I love you.
I hope so. I don't know. There is
something fascinating to me as I look around this table of the kind. I mean, I've read work by everyone that's sitting at this table. You're in a medium that is ridiculously dominated by costume superheroes. And aside from Scott Big Time Kowalczyk, none of you do superhero comics.
I did one. You're tainted forever. but the thing is, okay, here's the thing. With that one was for me more than it was anyone else. Like, that one I created for myself. And is there going to be more? Probably. There's probably going to be more. But they're always going to be for me.
And I think it's also fair to say that there are artists who love to draw Spider-Man.
Absolutely.
Sure. And that, like, there's
somebody... Okay. And they're the ones who should be.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like being that guy with the dance move, though. It's like, that's all he's got.
That's true.
Who wants to be recognized for that one thing they do so well? I don't know. That seems silly.
What life story does this
guy? But maybe they do. In which case, more power to them, right?
Yeah. You guys watch Knocked Up, right?
No.
The dice move, that's all he's got.
Oh, the dice move, man. Yeah, I can do that move as well.
Yeah. If you draw Spider-Man.
It's a terrible movie.
It is terrible. It's not a terrible movie. It's a great movie.
I'm saying that right now. It's not on the internet. Terrible movie.
Have kids,
I'm loving
it's a great
this conversation.
Movie.
Awesome.
People who are not parents hate that movie.
It upset no
kids. It is two and a half hours of jokes for parents.
It's
Oh, they did that too. It's okay. It's okay.
Validation.
I would like it if Justin would just finally give Scott a chance to talk. And, you gotta have some opinions over there. We haven't heard much from you. What are you thinking?
Oh, baby, you are on.
You're on.
You are on deck right now.
Let's go.
No, I agree with Scott. I agree with both points where it's like...
They're both right. All the points are right. Like,
grass
like,
is greener.
But the thing is, if you want to draw Spider-Man, you have to go to this particular company and do what they want you to do.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So if you don't like what he says and you don't follow him, that's fine, but you won't work for Marvel.
You can't draw Spider-Man
that's fine.
Your
that's,
way.
That doesn't have to be what you have to do, but that's the only way to do that particular job.
Isn't it? It was back in like...
And so we learned that life is full of compromise.
I think it's persisting. Because they might not like you at first.
I don't like you now.
No one likes me ever. But no one... You might not be liked at first. But over time... As people progress on comics, they become accepted. Either they're accepted by popularity, or they're accepted by, hey, I realize that now this style is fitting for this book type of thing. Trad Moore's pages, when his very first portfolio submission, like his first portfolio phrases, were crazy. Like, they were awesome. And they had, like, tons of detail and tons of things. And, like, Fing Fan Foom fighting, I forget the characters, I think it was Fantastic Four or something like that. And, you know, buildings and everything that's so cool now, when he did them and did a submission, he wasn't hired on the spot. And it's crazy. But then, you know, 5 years later or however long that passed, all of a sudden he's, like, you know, doing Ghost Rider or something like that, right? And it's perception of, and it's exactly the same art, but it's the perception of what he did then is just different than either by popularity, where he just became popular, and so and then, you know, Marvel goes, oh, people actually like this style. Maybe we will do something.
That's what Mo was saying about the people who will work for Marvel are the 30% that are working for Image or something.
No.
You do a series there, and then it's like, oh yeah, 6 issues of that, I get. 2 like black and white pages, I couldn't really see it, and I was like, yeah, come on over.
But it's funny when someone will say, no, don't draw your buildings like this, or, you know, study perspective like this, or, like, you know, that's a crazy looking leg you have on Spider-Man, please don't ever do that again. It's funny that it's pushed away sometimes, but then accepted later on.
Yeah.
And there's
pouches.
But there's no real right way to get into comics, and
yeah.
and whether I mean I've been reviewed by Cebulski, and but everything went fine.
Yeah.
And then, you know, but I've gotten different reviews from different people, and one person is saying, you're almost there. Just try a little harder and do this a little bit longer while I'm in the middle of doing comics. I've been told that. And then, you know, other people are like, yeah, let's do something. And but everyone has their own position of what they see in your art.
Yeah.
And they see one, your style is, like, really awesome, or they see your style as, like, really, like, terrible. And you just got to sort of focus on what, you keep on doing what you want to be doing. Without, you know, making compromises, I guess is what I'm saying, is, like, you know, just like for example, you said you want to be drawing,
yeah,
and making money doing that, right? If you were, would you rather be drawing what you want to be doing and making barely any money, or would you want to be drawing
something you didn't know?
Your most hated thing, but making lots of money. Like, there's different.
Well, like, and to put it in perspective.
And you're going to encounter that. I encounter that with the comics that I draw.
There's
And I'm like, I hate this. But you just go
Mike
through
McNullen
it.
Told me that. Mike McNullen told me that at a show. I've told the story in the show of a horrible experience with a creator where I put a work in front of him, and he told me the experience of doing that book. You know, and from my perspective as someone who really enjoyed the work, it was a bad experience. But here was a human being, a creator, who told me the Alpha Flight was the book that was in front of him. And he said he woke up every day hating his life because that was another day he had to draw Alpha Flight.
But Alpha Flight got him to making Hellboy, right? It got people to know his name. It got John Byrne on board to write Hellboy for him. It got Dark Horse to notice it.
But it's not the only avenue.
No, it's not.
Right? It's really not.
The jump with exactly Twitter.
I think people, we all just need to make sure that we're not becoming trapped in someone else's definition of quality, in someone
success,
else's definition
sure.
of art, and someone else's definition of success.
Yeah. So
because that's
yourself,
what makes us incredibly unhappy.
People
right?
dream on different levels, right?
That's
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's what the alternative is to some degree, too. So he hated Alpha Flight. I get what you guys are saying. And so now, like I said, I earn my living as a writer. I write these big fucking ponderous corporate reports, right, for the government and stuff like that.
Love it.
I went to school to, like, learn journalism, and I wrote entertainment for years so that I could go on to write fiction. It's like, well, I'll get a job like my heroes, Ernest Hemingway, Gray McDonald, who invented Fletch and all that kind of stuff. But in reality, I do this shit I hate. Like, I loathe what I write. But as much as I loathe writing that, I'd rather write shit I hate writing than go and work in Fort McMurray or go pound nails or, you know, so. But the next guy might go, you know what, if I can't write that novel that's in me,
I would rather go and be a janitor.
And I know
it depends on the individual, right? Yeah. Me, I would rather write, because at least I'm close to the craft I like, you know, and I'm still working with words, and I'm still, you know.
And you're learning something.
Yeah, I'm still doing stuff that I can take home and I crack open Illustrator and sit down and write dialogue, you know. I can also kind of moonlight sneak some stuff in, you know. We've all done that, right? But you know, other guys might not be able to stomach that. Like, if they can't create the art they love, they don't even want to, you know, they don't want to paint sad clowns or the shit that you see in the art section of, like, there is one in Canadian Tire or Walmart, you know. They'd rather, like, I'll paint nothing, you know, if I can't actually paint what I love. And it depends on the person you're talking to some degree, right? You know, being true to themselves.
There's some visual artists that can do advertising design and poster design, and there are some that can't.
Yeah.
And there's some that can't go to, like, show up at 9 a.m. and start.
Yeah, you look at, like, Art Spiegel, who I think is a, people are tired of talking about, but he's a transcendent artist, I think, and there's a guy that created, like, some brilliant art, you know, and at the same time, he's got, like, this huge corporate legacy that would have put his name in history on its own if he never created Mouse or never created any of his underground comics, or if he never did that Haight-Ashbury comic scene, you know. And you got other guys that could not do that for 1 second, you know. So
I see somebody who, like J. Scott Campbell, who just does covers for other companies and books. Doesn't do his own books. Doesn't do his own thing anymore. The Gen 13, all he does is
does
covers.
Loves, so
but yeah,
happy,
I mean,
awesome.
I'm not going to judge him for that. There's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely.
So are superheroes are the dominant genre right now in comics.
We're still going.
I had to celebrate Christmas with my family.
Actually, have we gotten to the next Christmas art?
No, it's just I was out of town and now I gotta go.
Well, that's it. I mean, we're at 2 hours now.
Okay, do we want to wrap it up? Well, it'll take us another half an hour to go around the table.
I think at least we'll give people a chance if they
to
want
be continued.
To.
I hopefully we'll be doing something in the summertime-ish and. Maybe we'll see about. And Brett and I are starting to put together some ideas of what we're doing at the Calgary Expo. So, thanks everyone for coming. We'll do a round around the table so you can plug how to get a hold of you. Most importantly, how to see your art. How do people find your art? Because we have now curated a list of comics that you can track down now, and you should. Once you're finished,
well, and the thing is, not only to give us your art, but I mean, if you do have a final thought, I do give it, because one of the things is when you have 16 people in a table like this, and especially when you have people like Nick, you just won't shut up. And but when you do, I mean, I think it's difficult necessarily for a reader to understand who's saying what and what their actual opinion is and who was that and I agree with that person. I want to follow their product, but. They might not know who it was saying what. So do kind of wrap up your final thoughts, perhaps. And we'll go around and start with Rick.
Go the other way.
We'll start
with Rick.
I need 10 seconds to find out what happened if you actually Googled my comic. You know, it's one thing I wanted to pick up for a second. And you can. So.
Well, now that you've said that, you might as well go ahead.
All right, so what was the question again?
Where are you?
Rick's done.
Who are you? Where are you? Well, yeah, I guess it'd be a lie to say we'd love you to check out our comic. We're doing everything we can to actually show that we're here to stay and not be a one and done. Futility issue 3 is in production. We'll be out in February. It's looking like maybe later February, boys. And we'll have number 4 of the first 4 issue arc out for the Calgary Comic Con, Compeller High Water. So that'll be 4 comics in a year, which we think is fairly good. Guys, no money, and all that kind of stuff. You can also Google Nathan Miller and Cam Hayden and find a ton of stuff about one of these guys' drawings as well. And if you Google Futility Comic, you'll find us.
And what was your name?
My name is Rick Overwater.
Overwater.ca.
Yes.
I'm Nathan, and you can find my work on whereshewalks.ca. Thank you.
I'm Erin. You can also find my work at whereshewalks.ca.
I'm Cam from Futility. So everything that Rick said, you can find us at the Calgary Expo between a person selling purses and probably Do it. Helmets.
Yeah, there it is.
Your garbage photos can. Of cosplayers.
Yes.
Scott Kowalczyk at scottkowalczyk.com. Oh, I have to renew my domain, so probably scottkowalczyk.com.
I'm taking the domain.
Yeah.
Yet another way to get into the column.
That's going to be a problem. Downset Fight, my book with Oni, sold out like 6 months ago, and Oni hasn't let anyone know. So hopefully this is a good place to start and get them to talk about it. Yeah, I've got a book next Christmas. It's going to be great, and we're going to be talking about that nonstop. And at Twitter, Scott Kowalczyk.
Which you're not on, ever.
I hate Twitter.
Oh, it's the best.
I hate it, man. Twitter is just a
That's how I panhandled for
That's how I found out about the Wolfans Christmas.
Yeah,
speaking of that guy.
Did you tweet anything about that Christmas?
No.
No?
I haven't mentioned it.
Oh.
Justin Higgs, check out Wolfhands at wolfhandscomic.ca. And yeah, the Christmas special just came out on the 25th.
That's right.
See, it works.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm Nick Johnson, artist of the Wolfhands. You can check out my stuff at the wolfhandscomic.ca. Also have an art portfolio site at nickj.ca. And that goes to my art blog, which I try to keep updated with all my illustration and comics and stuff. But
what happened to Nick Soup?
Nick Soup is the name of the blog. But I don't want to be like, go to nickj.ca, go to nicksoup.blogspot.com. Actually, I took away the blog spot, so it's nicksoup.com, which is very official. It's good that I didn't get overcomplicated.
Now we know them all.
You know just what to say to get my trap going.
Should have started with that. Tell us about your domain.
I'm Jason Memel, a writer and publisher of Fight Comics. And you can find that at fightcomics.ca.
Salesman.
I'm
Chris Peterson, a totally generic name so you can never Google me. Or you'll find serial killers and stuff like that, which isn't too bad.
What?
So my domain is versusrobots.com, and Twitter is the same thing. And yeah, I got some books coming out in March. Probably by the time this podcast comes out, I have no idea if you can pre-order them or not, but you can pre-order right now for you guys.
Mayday
and also the Grindhouse book are both in previews right now. And I don't know what's going on with Incidentals exactly, but I know it's supposed to be coming out in May. And then the other project coming out in June. So a bunch of stuff over the next couple, little while. There you go. Sweet.
Sounds exhausting.
That's it.
It is exhausting.
But it's your enthusiasm that sells it.
I just need to get through like January and February, then after that it should be pretty good because it's just because of the Grindhouse.
Any criticism is my salesmanship.
He just said he was a serial killer. And I own a car. It doesn't have a very good transmission.
He doesn't own a car. He has a van with no windows.
I'm Taylor Stuffed. Uncaged, the comic I drew, is going up on Comixology Submit soon. You can find me at Taylor Stuffed on Twitter. STAUFT, because people always misspell it. And taylorstuffed.tumblr.com. And we'll be posting pages of the new project we're working on, too. So check us out.
Who's us?
Yeah. Oh, Benjamin Bailey. You can find him on Twitter at Ben H. Bailey.
Sounds familiar.
He runs and does work for IGN.
Okay, yeah.
And does the Assemble After Dark podcast with Joey Esposito. Who is that? Joey Esposito on Tumblr.
Nice.
Okay, well, I am Stephen Charles Rozia. Had fun. You can find me at www.withoutatitle.com and possibly at the new Scott Kowalczyk domain.
God damn it, I should
have. I'm renewing it right now.
I got a couple of anthology stuffs out there here and there. Lady Quest Future Bitch Volume 3, I got a story in.
That's a great
that
title.
Awesome.
That's a good one, yeah.
Lady
Quest Future Bitch. Yeah. Fearsome Fables Number 2, and my newest book, The Man Outside the Window, which can be bought at Alpha Comics and at my website. You can also find me at Twitter at Stephen Rosia.
Good. All right. Thanks, everyone, for coming. And if you do go to a convention this year, ask for who the local creators are.
I just want to, in particular, just want to thank Aaron for, without Chris Duker here, to also provide a female presence. It was nice for you to show up for once.
Why isn't Chris here?
He was supposed to be here, and then, you know, last second, family stuff.
We are OUT.
Aggressively, we all defend the role we play. Regrettably, time's come to send you on your way. We've seen it all, bonfires of trust, flash floods of pain. It doesn't really matter, don't you worry, it'll all work out. No, it doesn't even matter, don't you worry, that ain't what it's all about.
We hope you enjoyed your stay. It's good to have you with us, even if it's just for the day. We hope you enjoy your stay. Outside the sun is shining, seems like heaven ain't far away. It's good to have